Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
It's Friday, which is when we hear from StoryCorps. Now, over the years, hundreds of people have led us into their lives through the StoryCorps segments here on NPR News, but none more so than Lynn Weaver, who has appeared on our air four different times. We're sorry to report that Lynn Weaver has died over the weekend at the age of 69. We first heard from him in 2007 when he sat down to recall his father, Ted Weaver, a janitor and chauffeur in Knoxville, Tennessee. Lynn Weaver remembered a day when he was a kid struggling through high school algebra.
So my father said, "What's the problem?" And he said, "Well, let me look at it." I said, "Dad, they didn't even have algebra in your day." And I went to sleep. And around 4 o'clock that morning, he said, "Come on, son, get up." He set me at the kitchen table and he taught me algebra. What he had done is sit up all night and read the algebra book. And then he explained the problems to me so I could understand them. And to this day, I live my life trying to be half the man my father was.
Lynn Weaver went on to become a surgeon and chief of surgery at Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta. He came to StoryCorps multiple times over the years to pay tribute to his father and recall his own childhood, including integrating his high school in 1964 and playing for their football team.
There were always racial comments. I remember we played a all-white school. The game was maybe only in the second quarter. My brother tackled their tight end and broke his collarbone. And when they had to take him off the field with his arm in a sling, that's when the crowd really got ugly. We were on the visitor's sideline, and they were coming across the field. So we backed up against the fence. I remember the coach saying, "Keep your helmet on." So I was pretty afraid. And then a hand reaches through the fence and grabs my shoulder pads. I look around and it's my father. And I turn to my brother. I said, "It's okay. Dad's here." The state police came and escorted us to the buses. The crowd is still chanting and throwing things at the bus. And as the bus drives off, I look back and I see my father standing there and all these angry white people. And I said to my brother, "How's Daddy going to get out of here? They might kill him." We get to the high school, and the most incredible feeling I think I've ever had was when my father walked through the door of the locker room and said, "Are you ready to go?" As if nothing had happened. And I wanted to tell him, "Dad, don't come to any more games." But selfishly, I couldn't. I needed him there for me to feel safe. Normally, when you're with a team, you feel like everybody's going to stand together. And I never got that feeling that the team would stand with me if things got bad. I think a number of the white students who were there with me would say, "Now, if I could have did something different, I would have said something." But that's what evil depends on. Good people to be quiet.
College don't mean shit. Y'all niggas, and you gon' be niggas forever, just like us, niggas.
Throughout New York, some places are still named with racial slurs and other offensive language. WXXI's Veronica Volk asks, how does that impact the people who live there?
Bruce Farrington is the historian for the village of Sodus Point. He stands on a stretch of beach on the south shore of Lake Ontario, looking over to a piece of land that juts out into the water. It's called Freedom Hill.
There was a large group of people in this area that were strongly against slavery, and they risked 6 months in prison and a $1,000 fine to help the slaves in taking them across to Canada where freedom was.
Freedom Hill, it is widely believed, was a final stop on the Underground Railroad.
As a betting person, I would believe that the people would be up there on the hill looking for that schooner coming their way.
But this place wasn't always called Freedom Hill. It used to be referred to with the N-word.
Nigger!
Farrington suspects the place was likely labeled with the racial slur by bounty hunters chasing fugitive slaves in the North before the Civil War. And the name stuck until in 1963, the federal government ordered that the offensive term be replaced with Negro in all geographic names. While most locals call it Freedom Hill, this place and 24 other places across the state still officially contain the word Negro. To the west, a small strip of land jutting into Port Bay is still referred to on Google Maps as Negro Head Point. Fred and Marilyn Nyer live there. I visited them on a Saturday afternoon while they sat on their back deck with children and grandchildren. Marilyn says she believes the name came from the Underground Railroad as well.
I'm almost positive they would go to Canada from there.
An alternate theory, put forth by town historian Rosa Fox, is that it was named that because a black family lived on the point in the 1800s. She says there's plausibility to both stories. Regardless of its origins, Fred Nyer didn't agree with changing the name.
Personally, I think it's a part of our history, though, and I don't think we should lose our history just to be politically correct. I mean, I think we should understand it and know it, but I don't think we should change the map because it's not politically correct at this point in time.
Peter Evans, the Wayne County historian, agrees.
This wholesale renaming, tear down everything that had to do with representations of the South, of slavery, tear it all down. Get rid of it. And, you know, I'm not saying it was good, but it's what it was. And should we ignore that?
As an African-American, I have a interesting perspective.
Eric McNair is the vice president of Wayne Action for Racial Equality.
We can acknowledge history. We can acknowledge the things that have occurred. But that doesn't mean that those things don't require change.
McNair says he's not surprised by those who say the name shouldn't change. Wayne County's population is 94% white.
Your personal experience affects whether or not something is offensive to you.
McNair says he's experienced a lot of prejudice in the county as well, and that having places named after slurs may perpetuate that prejudice. He says in his capacity at Ware, he's working to change not just the names of these places, but the culture.
And I think that as African Americans and an African American community is just now taking a larger stand and putting boundaries on these things and saying, hey, these things can't happen. We can't call these places these names anymore. We can't do that anymore.
It's not impossible to change a name, though it is laborious. In Buffalo, it took 2 years to rename Unity Island, originally called Squaw Island. Veronica Volk, WXXI News.
And all the while, I kept thinking about that great old Whitman poem. When I heard the learned astronomer.
I don't know it.
Anyway.
Well, can you recite it?
Pathetically enough, I could.
All right, well.
Oh.
No, come on. Come on.
When I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and the diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer where he lectured, with much applause in the lecture room. How soon, unaccountable, I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself in the mystical morning. moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars. Yes, I am a nerd.
Bravo.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition on WNYC. I'm Richard Hake. This week marks the 200th birthday of poet Walt Whitman. Events all over the city are commemorating the legendary poet, including several at the Brooklyn Public Library. Whitman, of course, lived and worked in Brooklyn for many years. Earlier this month, the library hosted a critical debate about Whitman's most celebrated work, Leaves of Grass, examining the writing through a racially diverse lens. Poet Harmony Holiday was on that panel, and WNYC's cultural critic Rebecca Carroll spoke with her about the experience, and she joins us now. Hi, Rebecca.
Hey, Richard.
So first, tell us more about Harmony Holiday. Why was she in particular chosen for this panel?
So Harmony Holiday is a writer, an archivist, and performance artist who has published 4 critically acclaimed collections of poetry, and she's currently at work on a biography of Abby Lincoln, as well as an epic about reparations and the black body. She, I thought, was a really interesting choice for this conversation about Whitman because she's very musical. Her father is American R&B singer-songwriter Jimmy Holiday, and she has a very keen command of archival sound and audio and language. And Whitman, of course, did a lot with language, much of what was considered quite unprecedented, groundbreaking, and ahead of its time. So her take as a black woman poet on this canonized white male poet is really vivid.
So what did she have to say about Whitman's relationship to race?
So she discovered Whitman in high school as required reading, as many of us did. Mm-hmm. But she said she didn't really feel anything about him in regard to race until she was in college and read Leaves of Grass. And she had actually tweeted about that recently, about how she wondered what it would have felt like for Malcolm X if he had had the luxury to just lay in the grass reading Shakespeare.
I think about that a lot because I think a lot of black revolutionaries loved language, and that was where it was come to. I mean, even James Baldwin, I was just watching The Price of the Ticket last night, and he was talking about not thinking of himself as a revolutionary. He wants to be a writer, but he's not just going to sit around in some tower and cultivate his talents. Those were his words. And that's sort of like what Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and people like that sacrifice when they go and use their speaking and language talents to scream because they have no choice. We don't know what poets we would have had. And coming from a background where my dad was a sharecropper and he didn't get taught to read or write and had to have friends and wives transcribe his music for him, I know what it means to want to be a poet or a writer and not have that tool given to you.
So it sounds like there are a few things at play here. There's the era that Whitman was writing in and the luxury he had that black poets did not, and then Whitman's own feelings about race.
Yeah, specifically about black people. I mean, he was racist by the standards of the 1800s and of the 2000s. And I was really curious to know how Holiday discussed that on the Brooklyn Public Library panel and also the broader repercussions of identifying this in Whitman's work. We've all heard that whole, well, that was another time argument. Yeah. But how do you reconcile with racism of a canonized poet?
Yeah.
Is there a new way to engage with racism that we have yet to discover?
I think there's a new level of honesty. I think we can look at his work with that in our minds instead of what we were taught in the past as readers. If you're brought into academia, you're told to look at a work just for what it is on the page. And I don't think that that's fair anymore to readers, you know, the diversity of readers we have and the people who are being forced to read him. There's a student at Northwestern who was going to get, I think, a PhD, and he got failed in a class because he didn't want to recite Whitman because he had found some research about his racism and him calling black people baboons, literally. So it's like we're allowed to read his poems and know that and think about that while we're reading them instead of just read his poems and think about the great ahead of his time. I think tropes like someone being ahead of their time and think like that's problematic because he was of his time. Right. He just was hiding that stuff.
But there are scores of well-known poets and writers who have been influenced by Whitman. Some, such as Black writer June Jordan, who used her own work to be in critical conversation with his work. Did you talk with Holiday about that?
I did, and specifically Jordan's essay, For the Sake of People's Poetry, Walt Whitman and the Rest of Us, in which she explores Whitman's queer outsider identity. I feel like she was trying to make a case for teaching in a different way, like a new pedagogy of poetry. And she was using him because there were no better examples. But I don't think that was the best example. And some of the lines she quoted, like she quoted this section of one of his poems where he talks about helping a slave auctioneer and how he doesn't know the worth of the body, as him being really, the word abolitionist came up
right
on Sunday. And I'm like, he's not, that's not an abolitionist. He's talking about helping. So it's like reading things with a hope. You know, like, but that's not really what he's saying. He was still referring to the black body as an it, and he was still helping a slave auctioneer sell that body.
And, of course, now we're living in what's called cancellation culture. Are we canceling Walt Whitman?
I mean, I probably would, but Holiday had a very sound answer to that. This is America. Like, no one's letting go of the precious Walt Whitman and all the ideological, egoic energies that he holds for so many. He's not going anywhere. So I think the point is to try to read him as a fixture. Instead, it's almost like the opposite of cancellation culture. It needs to be explored. Since he is basically a statue in this culture, we have to be able to permeate some of that stone and chip away at the bull, basically.
And Rebecca, you mentioned to me that Holiday is working on a project about reparations and the black body. Is there a connection between that project and her feelings about Whitman and race?
I think so, yeah. I asked her what she thought white America owes the black body and what Walt Whitman might owe the black poet. And here's what she said. If we can imagine past Walt Whitman, what would a black Walt Whitman at that time have sounded like? I feel like that's what we owe ourselves when we're thinking about his bicentennial. Let's also think about all those ghosts, you know, and tools to mine those ideas through listening back to thinking about spirituals and where our poetry really was, even with like tap dancing and worked songs and things like that. And really, I guess, piecing, that's why I love the archive so much, like piecing together what our sound might have been if it hadn't been taken away in written language, not just verbally in song, you know.
Walt Whitman turns 200 on May 31st. Harmony Holiday is the author of four collections of poetry, including Go Find Your Father, A Famous Blues. WNYC's cultural critic, Rebecca Carroll, thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
Every night, all the time.
If you are pregnant and you smoke some pot to relieve morning sickness, is that harmful for your baby? That's what researchers at the University of Washington are trying to find out. Dr. Natalia Kleinhans is leading a new study at the UW School of Medicine. She told me about what they're trying to learn and who's taking part in this research.
This study is targeting a very specific group of women who are pregnant, are experiencing morning sickness, and have decided to use cannabis to treat their morning sickness.
They've decided on their own to do this.
Absolutely. So when we see them, they're usually going to be towards the end of their first trimester, so they've been using cannabis already before they sign up to see us.
And what are you hoping to find out?
So what we're trying to do with this study is to gather scientific data on the risks of using cannabis during pregnancy to control morning sickness. So right now, if you're a woman and you have morning sickness and you go talk to your doctor and ask, you know, is this pharmaceutical Zofran safer for my baby than cannabis? There's just no data available right now to answer that question. You know, so ultimately what we want is to help women make better informed choices.
So, doctor, how will the study work?
So we'll enroll women in the study. We ask them questions to make sure they qualify. We will give them a drug test to make sure that they're not using tobacco, alcohol, or other drugs. And then we're going to ask them throughout their second and third trimester to report in a weekly diary their marijuana use, vitamins, exercise, morning sickness, We're going to give them two drug tests throughout that time just to continue to verify that they're not using other substances. Once the baby is born, we'll get some information on birth outcomes, such as weight, head circumference, Apgar score, those types of things. And then 6 months later, we'll have the baby and the mom come back in. And that's when we'll do the extensive developmental evaluation where we're looking at cognition, social skills, motor development, and then doing our sophisticated brain imaging measures to look at brain development.
Now, all that information is to come, but what do we know right now about how marijuana can affect the brain development in infants?
So it's actually very difficult to understand exactly what the effect of marijuana has on brain development or on infant outcomes. The reason is that previous research included women who were using marijuana, but who were also using tobacco and alcohol. And these substances, we know, are associated with severe birth defects and adverse outcomes. So some studies have shown there are negative effects with marijuana, but these effects actually go away once you control for other environmental factors or tobacco and alcohol. The most consistent one that has been reported is low birth weight. So on the one hand, it could be that there really aren't significant adverse outcomes associated with marijuana use, but it could be that there are more subtle outcomes that we just don't see when you lump it in there with marijuana and alcohol use.
Doctor, do you see any ethical concerns when it comes to doing this kind of research?
I think people are very concerned about testing out medications, drugs on pregnant women. However, the women in our study have decided on their own to use marijuana. They're using it regardless of being in this study or not. In that case, this is an observational study. We're not telling women how much marijuana to use. We're not telling them what to use. And if they stop using marijuana, they're still part of our study. An observational study like ours isn't the best design for answering a scientific question, but we do it this way because this is the ethical way to do it.
Dr. Natalia Kleinhans is Associate Professor of Radiology at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Dr. Kleinhans is aiming to recruit 70 women in total. Half will be in the test group and the other half in a control group. Funding for the research comes from the U.S. National Institute of Drug Abuse.
The man knot, race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
In 1991, the late director John Singleton's Boys in the Hood came out in theaters. Coverage of Rodney King being beaten by Los Angeles cops was playing practically on a loop on television screens. And this song by a Houston rap group called the Ghetto Boys brought never-before-heard vulnerability to the subgenre known as gangster rap.
My mind is playing tricks on me.
Today, as part of our American Anthem series, NPR Music's Rodney Carmichael is here to talk about how Mind Playing Tricks became an anthem and laid the groundwork for generations of young black men to express their anxiety. Hi, Rodney.
Hey, Noel. What's going on?
Tell us about this song and what it meant.
Noel, Mind Playing Tricks on Me was practically my theme song when it came out. And it wasn't just me. In the fall of 1991, you could hear this song bumping out of just about every car with speakers in the trunk. It really put a voice to the angst and paranoia that defined what it meant to be a young black man in America at the time.
I sit alone in my four-cornered room, staring at candles. Who got me? Real radio joke.
I mean, there's already a post-traumatic stress that comes along with being black in this country. It's almost part of your inheritance, right? And in the 80s and the 90s, remember, things got even deeper. The crack era, the war on drugs, over-policing and mass incarceration. I mean, this was the era when it wasn't at all unusual to hear young black men referred to as an endangered species. And the worst of it is, we were being told that we were the ones that we should fear the most. Now just imagine how that plays with your psyche.
At night I can't sleep, I toss and turn. Candlesticks in the dark, visions of bodies being burned. Four walls closing in, getting bigger. I'm paranoid, sleeping with my finger on the trigger.
Now the Ghetto Boys, Noel, they were already legendary in the South. But this song right here, it made them huge everywhere. And it gave Scarface, the member who wrote the majority of the song, more Southern Gothic street cred than Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, he was born Brad Jordan, but he took on the name of one of the most celebrated figures in rap, Scarface the Kingpin from the classic Al Pacino movie.
So he's written this song about paranoia, about angst, about worry. How much of that was really part of his life?
Well, it was a combination of his own imagination, but also his own lived experience. He wrote 3 of the 4 verses in the song, with group members Willie D and Bushwick Bill carrying the rest of the load. But it's actually Scarface's grandmother who deserves credit for the song's title. And she talked about it several years ago with MTV.
I think I was just kind of mumbling to myself, or my lips was working or something. He said, Mama, he said, what are you talking about? I said, oh, no, nothing in my mind, just playing tricks on me. And then had no idea he was going to be going out making a song about it.
That is really remarkable.
Yeah, so Scarface, he's a musician from a family, long line of musical talent. And he was also a high school dropout who got involved with the local drug trade when he was coming up. But Noel, he also spent some time in a hospital psych ward after he attempted suicide once as a teenager. Now, you know, therapy was still pretty taboo in most Black communities, but learning to express his feelings, it just really made him a cold songwriter. Now, just listen to this second verse. One moment, he's in church praying for an exit out the drug game, and the next, he's contemplating suicide before getting a grip.
Day by day is more impossible to cope. I feel like I'm the one that's doing dope. Can't keep a steady hand because I'm nervous. Every Sunday morning, I'm in service, praying for forgiveness and trying to find an exit out the business. I know the Lord is looking at me, but yet it still is hard for me to feel happy. I often drift when I drive, having fatal thoughts of suicide. Bang and get it over with, and then I'm worry-free, but that's nonsense.
Now the thing is, you didn't have to be an ex-drug dealer like Scarface to relate to this song. You didn't even have to be from the ghetto like Ghetto Boys. If you were Black, if you felt the pressure of growing up with a target on your back, Mind Playing Tricks was like your anxiety anthem. I mean, this was confessional rap. It was like street ministry. And it felt like he was telling us it's okay to acknowledge these emotions that we've been conditioned to hide. His message made it to some pretty unconventional spaces at the time, too.
The first time I actually heard the song analyzed and broke down was at church, shawty. Somebody was preaching at church.
Okay. That's Maurice Garland, music journalist and Southern hip-hop historian. He's telling me about the first encounter that he had with the song as a kid back in the 90s.
You know how preachers do their little analogies with their sermons? Yeah. It's like, and you know, it's like that Ghetto Boy song, when your mind's playing tricks on you. He was breaking down like the depression, the drugs, the anxiety, the everything. He was corralling all this into his sermon. And that was like one of the first rap songs that I could remember where topics like that were even touched on, you know what I'm saying?
So it was a very big deal for a gangster rap song to show this kind of vulnerability, to have the word nervous in it.
Yeah, and a whole lot of other words. Gangster rap was basically considered America's nightmare back then, right? But, you know, it was also America's creation in some ways. The music was rebellious, it was aggressive, it was misogynistic and hyper-masculine to a fault. But one thing that it hadn't been much up until that point was vulnerable. And Mind Playing Tricks really became that first vulnerable gangster rap song. Think about it. This is almost a whole decade before Tony Soprano even had a psychiatrist on TV.
Yeah.
So the Ghetto Boys, they really turned their fear inward with this song. They were hardcore hustlers in the song, but they weren't glorifying the streets. They were traumatized by them. Listen to this verse from Willie D.
I make big money. I drive big cars. Everybody know me. It's like I'm a movie star, but late at night, something ain't right. I feel I'm being tailed by the same sucker's headlights.
So this is 1991. Mm-hmm. In 2019, what would you say the legacy of this song is today?
Well, you know, this song, it made mental health a topic of conversation way ahead of its time in certain Black communities. And it's still resonating. I mean, just last year, popular radio personality Charlamagne Tha God, he wrote a whole book about confronting his anxiety and getting help for it, and it was totally inspired by the song. Now we got artists who regularly process their pain on record. It's a whole subgenre known as emo rap. Artists like Juice WRLD, Lil Uzi Vert, even Post Malone, they're all clearly descendants of the Ghetto Boys, and Scarface in particular, whether they know it or not. So there's still pain and a whole lot of the wrong coping mechanisms, but at least rappers who represent the streets aren't afraid to use their music as a way to express it anymore.
Rodney Carmichael, thanks so much.
Thank you, Noel.
Ronnie Carmichael writes about hip-hop for NPR Music, and we've been talking about Mind Playing Tricks on Me by the Geto Boys.
New laws across the country would actually make it illegal for people to call the police on black people simply because they are black. A proposed ordinance, this is in Grand Rapids, Michigan, would make it a criminal misdemeanor to racially profile people of color for participating in their lives, what Jen calls living while black, and subject people behind those 911 calls to a $500 fine. And this is after two incidents there made the news. One, where police were actually called to a graduation party at a public park. The attendees were mostly black, and they said a noise complaint against them was really about white residents who were uncomfortable with a large gathering of black people. And then there was another incident months later in which police handcuffed two unarmed black 11-year-old brothers after a phone call reported a teen with a gun. In Oregon, you may remember the story, Democratic State Rep. Janelle Bynum was actually going door to door in her district outside Portland to speak to constituents back in July, when a resident called police on her because she looked suspicious. Now, Bynum is backing a bill that would allow victims of racially biased 911 calls about non-crimes to sue the callers in small claims court for up to $250. Bynum's proposal actually recently passed the House and a Senate committee, but in Grand Rapids and other areas, there are other areas where these laws are being proposed. Critics are raising concerns, all right? And one of those concerns is making false crime reports is already illegal in many parts of the U.S. Another is that although it's relatively easy for police to show up at a scene to determine that there's no crime, it's harder to decide whether the 911 caller was acting in a racist manner in making a report. I don't think it is, if we're honest.
Well, sometimes it's going to be, sometimes it's not going to be. I think that's the truth of that. Mm-hmm. I kind of like that there's, you have some way to right this wrong. So I kind of like that door. But I do think some of the cases will be easy to, you know, be sort of obvious and some will not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I like the Oregon law better than I like the Michigan law. And I'd have to hear more before I made up my mind if I was in one of those legislatures, right? Because on the one hand, we all know if you're decent people, the severity of the problem, it's preposterous. There's the guys who got in the Starbucks situation where they used the bathroom and they were police were called on them. There was a Yale graduate student who was taking a nap in her dorm room. Who sneaks into a dorm room at Yale to take a nap, right? And she has a student ID card. It doesn't matter. Harangued, illegally barbecuing in a park that's not a thing. In Michigan, this in the story that Brooke just told you about. They got a permit for their graduation party.
Right.
See, so I want people to understand, no matter what you think the right solution is, that unfortunately, African Americans in this country live almost a different life than non-African Americans.
Right.
Like, I would never even imagine getting a permit for a graduation party at a park. It wouldn't even cross my mind. Why would I? Like, if somebody told me that, I'd be like, don't waste your time. You don't need a permit. It's a park, right? But black folks have to go prepare ahead of time in case cops come, in case somebody calls on you, etc. Then there was the four businesswomen who were had the cops called on them for playing golf. I mean, what? And then we just covered one today, the guy picking up trash in front of his own apartment building.
Yeah.
Who picks up trash in front of somebody else's apartment building? And how would that be dangerous? There's and then my favorite story of all time, the kid who was mowing the lawn for his neighbor. And the cops get called on that kid. Who mows somebody else's lawn? And how is that dangerous? So I understand the severity of the problem. And if you don't, you're trying not to see it. And when we explain to you the perspective of other people and you see it with your own eyes, if you reject it, it says something about you. It's saying, I don't care what other people experience. I only care about myself. And that's, so I'm asking you to look into that. Okay, now when you get into remedies, I think the number one remedy is training of cops, et cetera, because I don't want any of these folks getting hurt. The Grand Rapids, Michigan one, it's a little tough because it makes it a criminal misdemeanor. And yes, it's a fine, and $500 is a lot of money. But some people might have genuinely been calling it in because they thought it was not the lawnmower guy, not any of the ones we just mentioned, right? But there could be more borderline cases that we are not seeing, mm-hmm. right? But the Oregon one says, hey, look, if you think it's really egregious, you can take him to small courts claim. It's not criminal. And you can win $250. And there, at least a judge would get to decide, was it egregious or was it not egregious? And it's small claims court. It doesn't take much time. So I think that's an interesting one that they should consider. That's my take on all of it.
Yeah, I just want to say two things, because I think like it's important to note that these people aren't Klan members. They're not intentionally, but they don't realize that black people scare them, and that that's still the same problem, whether you have your hood on or you don't. That still negatively affects my life the exact same way. So I don't really care what your intent was. It's just the fact that a black person scared you and you actually called the police. And on the point where it's like, well, you know, we already have these laws against false crimes, we also have a law against murder everywhere. But lawmakers all across the country are still wasting taxpayer money and time talking about infanticide.
Yeah.
So it's just, this is something that happens to matter. I don't know.
So that's a great point. And I just want to build on what you said. A lot of times right wingers shut down and they go, oh, so, you know, if I'm worried about crime in my neighborhood, now all of a sudden you think I'm KKK. Mm-hmm. No, what we're saying is you don't have to be KKK. That's not the point. The point is maybe they're, and this doesn't just apply to right wingers, by the way. Unfortunately, the media has put this in a lot of our heads from the local news and the movies and everything else. And those stereotypes exist in the back of your head, and you might be doing harm to your fellow citizen without realizing it. And that's part of why we cover these stories.
When you're a cop, you can torment freely and see me valley, then seize an Audi, then beam proudly, turn a routine traffic stop to your season finale when you're a cop.
Over the last few decades, the Federal Way Police Department has drawn at least 11 civil rights lawsuits. KUOW's online managing editor, Isolde Raftery, took a closer look at these cases, including one from a young man named Josiah Hunter. She told me about what happened to Hunter one night back in 2014.
So 5 years ago, on this hot night in September, Josiah Hunter, who's a young man, he's 21, and his best friend, Junior Bazillion, drive to this AMPM in Federal Way. They buy a cigar, they smoke it, they get back into the car. It's actually Josiah's dad's car, a dark cherry Cadillac Seville. And then they hear a bang, like a clap of thunder. I mean, it's just like, boom. And they jump out of the car to see what's going on. And they see that a Dodge pickup has slammed into another car and bam, into this pole. They run to the crash, right? They want to help out. And they pick up a bumper in the road, some shards of glass, and they start waving by traffic. They're sort of seeing themselves as really helpful guys. And when the drunk driver walks off, they go get him and they return him to the scene. So they're feeling pretty good at this point about their position.
And then Federal Way police arrive. What happens after that?
Right. So the first officer on scene is a man named Chris Durrell. And when he arrives, he gets the feeling that Josiah Hunter and Junior Bazillion are just a little too involved. You know, at one point, Josiah picks up the drunk driver's wallet and he says he's trying to help him out because the wallet had fallen onto the curb. But to Officer Durrell, it looks like Josiah might be trying to steal from the scene. And then a second officer shows up and he checks in with Officer Durrell and he walks into the AMPM mini mart to talk with the clerk. And he asks her if she wants the cops to kick the two young men, so Josiah and Junior, off the property, what is called trespassing them. And she says no because she can't even see them. But the second cop steps out of the AMPM and announces that the clerk wants them trespassed. And this trespass is, it's key because this trespass means that Josiah and Junior can be arrested, right? So Josiah, hearing this, he walks away from the AMPM parking lot and he makes this giant U around the parking lot because he's trying to avoid the officer. But what he does at this point is he's going back to his car and his car is on the AMPM property. And so he goes to his car, he opens his car door and Officer Durrell comes up behind him, slams him against this car and puts him in a chokehold. And Josiah describes this as happening all in a blink of an eye. And he starts to feel weak and he feels his body sink. And he tries to tell Officer Durrell that he can't breathe, but he can't even talk at this point. And what comes out of his mouth sounds like a squeal. And after that, they were arrested and taken to jail and charged with resisting arrest and obstruction.
And as you report, this wasn't the first time that Officer Durrell put someone in a chokehold. What did you learn about his history at the Federal Way Police Department?
Right. So Chris Durrell is an expert at what police call a lateral vascular neck restraint. And Officer Durrell teaches it in Federal Way. And he has put at least 13 people in neck restraints in his 12-year career. These are chokeholds, the neck restraints. And 9 of those people became unconscious. Now, that may seem shocking to you. It was certainly shocking to me when I first read about this. But it turns out that when someone passes out in this neck restraint, the hold is considered successful. There's literally a box on the police form that you check to say successful if someone passes out.
Hmm.
And I should add, though, that, you know, Federal Way defends this. So Federal Way thinks that this hold is great and that actually it results in a lower use of force than, say, using a firearm. But NYPD bans these chokeholds. You might recall that Eric Garner died after being put in a chokehold. And so you asked about Durrell's history with the department.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a spotty history with the department. He's been sued 3 times in 12 years. And one of those times was by Josiah Hunter. And another time was when he fired at a man 14 times. That was deemed justified. And a third time was when he searched someone's house without a warrant. So in that case, the resident told him he could not enter, but he decided he was going to. And he handcuffed the resident and put him in the back of a patrol car.
Now, you talked to the Federal Way police chief about your story. How did he respond?
Chief Andy Huang is a huge advocate for his officers. He defended Officer Durrell vehemently. He called him polite and hardworking, and he said he's the kind of officer who wants to make a difference. He had stories about Officer Durrell performing CPR, which he said other officers don't necessarily do. And he feels that Officer Durrell is not at all a bad cop.
You've also been looking into the Federal Way Police Department's history of violent interactions. What did you find there?
I found at least 11 civil rights lawsuits in the last 20 years. That's the minimum amount. There may be others that I wasn't able to find. And I want to be clear that I'm counting lawsuits that went forward in the court system. I'm not counting what I determined were frivolous or fender benders, that sort of thing. So these would be physical sort of use of force lawsuits. And I'll tell you about one case that surprised me. There were quite a few, but it surprised me, I think, most because it never got picked up by the press. In fact, none of these cases got picked up by the press. But this is a case of a black teenager who was 8 weeks pregnant. This is 2002. She's sitting in her car with her girlfriends, and there's also a baby in the car. And an officer knocks on the window, and he asks them for their IDs. And he hands back the IDs, and she then gets out of the car. She thinks she's free to go. And he says, you know, you're not free to go. And he takes her down in what he calls a hair hold. And she says in her lawsuit that he then kneed her several times in the back. And he really, it was a rough situation. So then he arrests her on obstruction of a police officer, I think is what the charge is called. And he takes her to jail. And she's released hours later at 3 a.m. and she starts complaining of cramping. And 2 weeks later, she miscarries. Now, from what I understand from an OBGYN, it's actually hard to make the connection between what happened and the miscarriage because a lot of people do miscarry in the first trimester and the fetus is very protected. So it could have been a coincidence. The result of that case is that she settled with Federal Way for $42,000.
Now, back to the young man you were telling us about at the beginning of our conversation, Josiah Hunter. He filed a lawsuit against the department. What happened with his case?
His case went to trial last summer, and it lasted about a week, and the jury awarded him $640,000. Now, the Federal Way Police Department has appealed that to the Ninth Circuit, so this is still in legal limbo right now.
And what's happened to Josiah Hunter in the meantime?
He is now a longshoreman. A union longshoreman with the Port of Seattle.
KUOW's online managing editor, Isolda Raftery, thank you for your reporting.
Thank you, Kim.
The charges against Hunter were eventually dropped a year after his arrest. And after Hunter filed his lawsuit, a federal jury did find that Officer Durrell used excessive force when he put him in a chokehold. Hunter's case has also prompted the Federal Way City Council to take up discussions about police oversight. Isolda has written an in-depth story on this. You can read it at KUOW.org.
The Man Knot. Race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
How does someone become an adult after being robbed of a childhood? A new Netflix miniseries examines this question. It's based on the case of a group of black and Latino teenagers known as the Central Park Five. In April 1989, a woman was brutally beaten and raped in New York's Central Park. Five boys were pressured into false confessions and convicted. All served time.
When everything was going on, I couldn't really follow what was happening. I didn't get it. Inside, I started reading the articles, how they wrote them against us from the first days, all the transcripts, the straight up lies they told. I watched my tape. I don't even know who that kid is. I don't even recognize myself.
I know, Ray.
That's Freddie Meares, the actor who plays Raymond Santana, one of the five. The real Raymond Santana reached out on Twitter to the director and screenwriter Ava DuVernay, and he asked if she would tell the story of what he, Antron McRae, Kevin Richardson, Yusuf Salaam, and Corey Wise went through. DuVernay said yes. She talked with our co-host Noel King about how this project got started.
I get a lot of tweets. It happened on Twitter. It was shortly after Selma, and I got a tweet from Raymond Santana asking what would be my next film after Selma, Central Park 5. And this story is one that I knew. I was a teenager on the West Coast when they were teenagers on the East Coast. I remember it being in the news. I'd recently seen the documentary by Sarah Burns. So I paid attention to the tweet this time, and it meant a lot to be asked by them.
When you sat down to talk to these men for the first time, what were some of the things they told you that made you think, oh, there's so much more here than we know?
Well, the personal stories for Antron McRae, for example, whose family dynamic completely broke apart. He was a part of a gorgeous small family unit, his mother, his father, and himself living in Harlem. And on this particular night when he's brought in, his father is in the room with him, and his father is kind of blackmailed and pushed and coerced into forcing his son to confess.
Listen to me, Tron. I need you to do what the police want you to do. You gotta say what they want you to say.
They want me to lie.
I don't think of it like that. Just say what they want you to say.
Which the son does after much protest, and from there their relationship was never the same. The story is so poignant, but it's also so telling in terms of the fracturing of family that happens when, you know, one person is incarcerated.
Well, that part really comes through. I kept thinking as I was watching the movie, the whole family might as well be behind bars.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the best thing to liken it to for people that don't have anyone who's incarcerated is grief. You know, most of us have lost someone in our life, and we know what that feels like. So it's this idea of separation, but a presence that never allows the grief to change into anything else except a deep absence that is inescapable.
Your series is very blunt in its portrayal of police and prosecutors. These teenage boys, at this point they're boys, they are brought into interrogation. They are told, you'll get out of trouble if you confess. You show their faces very close up. And I wonder, was getting in that close, was that a choice to show us, to remind us that these were kids?
Well, yeah. I mean, every decision in the film was a choice as a director. Yeah. But I think the proximity of the camera to the subject was less about showing that they were kids and mostly about showing that they were terrified.
Please assign it. Please.
Angie. Just because you waive an attorney right now, it doesn't mean it's forever, right?
I don't even...
You get your brother home. You and your mother, figure things out with a lawyer. We'll clear this all up.
I don't want to stay, Angie. I don't want to stay anymore. I'm tired of being here. I don't want to be here anymore.
Come on, lady.
Please sign
it. We don't want to be here anymore.
I don't want to be here. I want to go home.
Okay, I'm a black or brown kid in a closed room with white men who are authority figures who have guns on their belts and badges. And so, yeah, the proximity to the camera and the choices and camera movement and framing and composition, all of that was to bring you into the heartbeat of the boys as their adrenaline starts to rush from the terror of where they were.
As recently as late November 2018, Linda Fairstein, who was the sex crimes prosecutor in the film she's played by Felicity Huffman, she was insisting that her office did nothing wrong. And I wonder, while you were researching this film, while you were doing interviews, did you have an opportunity to talk to anyone involved in the investigation or the prosecution?
We made the opportunity available to them to speak with me, and many refused. Some did speak to me,
and asked that it not be revealed that they did. But the character that you're speaking of, her real-life counterpart, refused to speak to me. Yeah.
Hmm. I know that you saw the film with some of the men. What did they think? How did they react when they saw this dramatization of their lives on screen?
A lot of tears, a lot of relief on their part, I think, feeling that their story was finally going to be told and seen and heard. And just a very intimate, personal, emotional moment that I think outweighs anything that I've experienced as a filmmaker up until this point. My goal was to tell their stories and to, you know, get the well done from them with tears in their eyes was everything I need.
Do you think that these men are at peace with what happened?
No, they're not at peace. No amount of money can bring back your childhood. Everything's been affected by this. Many people in this that I've come across the country over the past 4 years don't know how the story ends, just think Central Park 5, actually think they're just still incarcerated or that they got out, but they did it. Not everyone knows about the exoneration. There's so much you can't get back. So, yeah. No, I think they're far from peace. But I do hope there's satisfaction for them in at least being able to finally have their side of the story heard and seen.
That's filmmaker Ava DuVernay speaking with Noelle King about her new Netflix series, When They See Us. We should say Netflix is one of NPR's sponsors. We also reached out to former prosecutor Linda Fairstein for comment. She told us her attorney sent documents and videos related to the investigation to the series producers and that she would only agree to speak with them after they had reviewed the materials. Fairstein said she never heard back from producers after that. She also called the depiction of her in the series grossly inaccurate and said the film is a, quote, fictional dramatization of events.
Why haven't you learned anything?
Racial disparity in academic achievement remains one of the leading problems in American education, both at the K through 12 and the college level. A number of studies show greater diversity in the teaching profession can address some of those concerns. Hari Srinivasan has a look at a teacher training program that's aiming to increase diversity in the classroom and improve results all the way through college. It's the latest story in our special series on Rethinking College and part of our regular education segment, Making the Grade.
After class, are we subtracting time or adding time?
Adding time.
Francisco Martinez will earn his teaching certificate this month, but the 26-year-old teacher-to-be wants to be more to his students.
My goal is to be a good role model.
Martinez, who was born in the U.S. to immigrant parents, says that his own teachers in school were overwhelmingly white. He hopes his background will resonate with elementary school students in Fresno, California, where the district's enrollment is 67% Hispanic.
I feel like I can relate a lot to the students. Some of the experiences they're going through, I've seen myself. And I guess in a sense, I can kind of provide another ear or another person to rely on.
Martinez may be right.
I'm going to keep my welcome short because
Cassandra Herring heads an alliance that helps prepare teachers for diverse student classrooms.
We know from research that having a teacher of color actually can move student achievement. It actually can help keep kids in school and persist to college.
According to the National Center for Education Statistics, more than half of all public school students are either racial or ethnic minorities, and that number is only rising. At the same time, 80% of their teachers are white. Experts in higher education are trying to fix that gap.
We need to make sure that every single ed prep program is training every single teacher candidate to bring about student achievement gains for all learners.
While minority students have made gains in recent years, an achievement gap still exists between the races. According to the U.S. Department of Education, in some grades, the gap in reading and math achievement between whites and their Hispanic and black classmates remains in the double digits.
I'm so excited that we are here today for the spring convening.
Herring's alliance, called Branch Ed, launched a new initiative with colleges across the country to improve teacher preparation programs.
When we go into our classrooms, capture what you see and hear teachers saying and doing.
This month, the alliance met in Fresno at Vang Pao Elementary School to observe student-teacher candidates from California State University Fresno, including Francisco Martinez's class.
How many of us thought that was false? Raise your hand.
Observers used a rubric to assess the role of diversity in teaching and learning.
By looking through the lens of that tool, it gives educators, these faculty, the opportunity to reflect back on what they're doing on their own campuses.
When we come back from our observations, we want to process the information and then go deeper with it.
One observation came from Nikesha Williams, an assistant professor from North Carolina A&T State University.
There was one black female student in the classroom. She did not participate in sharing out. I didn't hear that girl's voice in the classroom holistically at all.
There's research that supports this marginalization of black females, particularly as it relates to math. And it struck me that as a teacher, you think about how can you be more inclusive? How can you dispel myths? How can you support this disproportionate representation?
Does teaching need to change as our demographics and as our country changes?
I think it does. I think the race-blind, color-blind, language-blind, culture-blind educational system of the past is failing us. It's obsolete. Because our classrooms are becoming so diverse, to not equip teachers to know how to really leverage that diversity in a positive way to move forward student achievement is only going to increase the achievement gap.
A shift toward what's called culturally responsive teaching, or cultural proficiency, is gaining traction among educators.
What are our attributes that we're measuring?
An attribute is a...
To better serve students of color, teachers create conversation about inequities and cultural relevance.
The time she got on what?
On the bus.
On the bus. Everybody say on the bus.
On the bus.
Francisco Martinez uses Spanish references in his lesson plans.
For example, there was one math lesson I led once. We were working with distances. So I said, so-and-so wants to go get an horchata beverage. How long does so-and-so have to walk to get that beverage? Before I could finish the sentence, so many kids were saying, oh, I've had horchata, horchata is great.
While California State University at Fresno has been successful at recruiting many minority teacher candidates, enrolling African-American males is still a challenge.
Let's see hands. Eric, what's different about it?
We do need to improve on how we recruit African-American males. I think nationwide that should be at the forefront of the discussion. Most of our students naturally blend into...
Laura Alamillo is the dean of the School of Education at the university.
And so the work we do in the Kremen School is to make sure that all of our educators come out fully prepared to work.
She recently visited local black churches to try and attract more African Americans toward a teaching career.
I think it's time to reach out to this particular community to see if there maybe I could spark some interest. It's not only the presence of a teacher of color, it's the lens, it's the mindset of coming with these, you know, just really valuable assets.
What does 1 hour and 30 minutes represent, Leslie?
Ultimately, cultivating great teachers is likely to be the best recruiting tool of all.
Most teachers, if you ask a teacher, why do you become a teacher? Their why is because they had a teacher, one teacher that inspired them, that encouraged them to be the best that they could be and pushed them.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Hari Srinivasan in Fresno, California.
5, 4, 3.
She's pure alligator, pure white.
2.
Albinos that do make it to reproductive age can't find a mate because they look funny.
1.
Albino
What's cute, fluffy, and white all over? And no, it's not a joke with a terrible punchline. You know I don't do those. It is, in fact, an all-white panda that wildlife experts in China say has been photographed for the first time in the wild. Terry Egan reports.
What's said to be the first of its kind to be photographed, this one has red eyes and is completely white. And it was caught while crossing the forest in the Wanlung Nature Reserve in Sichuan Province. According to researchers there, it was spotted by an infrared camera placed in the area some 2,000 metres above sea level. Now, various experts have said this might be a mutation, but according to one of them from the School of Life Sciences at Peking University, it's the first case of a wild panda having albino genes. In fact, it demonstrates that these genes exist in giant pandas. He also pointed out that the panda looked strong and was walking steadily, suggesting that the difference did not affect its health. As for the reserve, it said it'll increase the number of infrared cameras in the area so as to monitor this first all-white panda's life and activities.
That was Terry Egan.
Move, women. Janet and Janine Africa, free at last. For two Move women, Janet and Janine Africa, it had been decades since they walked the streets of Philadelphia or rode in a car. Decades? Yes. Over four, to be exact. Exactly 41 years since the urban war in West Philadelphia on August 8, 1978. Just a few days ago, they walked away from Cambridge Springs Women's Prison, got into a car, and began the long-awaited trek home. Some 6 months after their Move sister, Debbie Africa, was released. For Janet and Janine, entering the car was a trip into the future. For the car was full of electronic gadgetry. One sister, having not traveled by car in decades, experienced a brief bout of car sickness. But now, for the first time in 41 years, Janet and Janine Africa can walk in a park and smell the flowers. For the first time in 41 years, Janet and Janine Africa can walk down a city street unencumbered. For them, Philadelphia is surely not the city of brotherly love. Janet and Janine Africa are the last Move women held after the Move confrontation of August 8, 1978, when cops attacked the West Philadelphia Move house. Several Move brothers remain. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You see me, boy, in Virginia, come go, go, bang, bang, in Virginia.
A fuller picture is starting to emerge of what happened Friday afternoon when a gunman walked into a government office complex in Virginia Beach and killed 12 people. The gunman also died. This afternoon, Mayor Bobby Dyer spoke about the city's response to the mass shooting.
We will not be defined by this horror. We will go forward. We are a city of resiliency and resolve. The true character of our city is going to rest with our public, our citizens, and our neighbors.
I'm joined by NPR's Bobby Allen, who was at that briefing in Virginia Beach. Good afternoon, Bobby.
Hey, Don.
In a minute, we're going to hear from Virginia Governor Ralph Northam, but what more did officials say about the status of the investigation?
So what we learned is that federal investigators led by the FBI are now directing the evidence gathering portion of the investigation. So that basically means they're interviewing the shooter's former colleagues, his neighbors, people who knew him quite well, you know, really digging into his background. Federal officials say they also recovered two weapons from the gunman, and both were .40 caliber handguns. And they say the shooter purchased them legally.
Any new information about the 12 people killed in the office?
So we knew that all but one of the victims were government employees who were colleagues of the shooter. City officials say they're now helping families plan funerals, memorials, vigils. And at all those events, we're really expected to get kind of a fuller glimpse of the victims' lives, because right now we only really know their names and how long they worked in local government.
And what more do we know at this point about the gunman and what may have motivated him?
So all we know is his name is Dwayne Craddock. He was a 15-year employee of the local government here. He worked as an engineer in the city's utility department. Police have again and again strongly deflected questions about him since the rampage. Now, they're really trying to focus on those who died. So 11 of them were Craddock's colleagues. And police say, you know, in addition to the handguns, Craddock had extended ammunition magazines, so those high-capacity magazines, and he had this device device called a silencer. And some witnesses who were in the building at the time of the shooting said they heard like 40 and 50 shots fired. But authorities just won't talk about motives yet.
And what do we know about the kind of security the government office has had in place before the shooting?
So authorities say, you know, security in the complex is being reviewed. Some regulars to the municipal building who I just caught up with here repeatedly brought up that point. Like this guy I met, Doug Dykeman, he is a general contractor from Virginia Beach. You know, and he goes to the government complexes where the shootings happen like a couple times a week. He goes there to pull building permits. It's a pretty regular thing for him. And he told me, you know, when he walks in, he often wonders why there's no security at the door.
It's kind of scary because you can go in any of the offices. You can wander around the whole complex into all the buildings, but, you know, nobody supervising or nobody checking you out.
And the chief of police here, when I asked him at the press conference specifically about that, he said, yeah, it's under review, but they will not yet commit to increased security, you know, such as metal detectors. Yeah, you know, the police chief sort of suggested that at this point, that might be a bit of an overcorrection to subject every single public employee to have to go through a metal detector. But whether there's going to be increased security or not, we will see soon.
All right. That's NPR's Bobby Allen. Thanks.
Thank you.
And now we're joined by Virginia Governor Ralph Northam. Governor, thanks for taking the time for us today.
Yes, sir, Don. Thank you for talking to me and just a horrific tragedy here in Virginia Beach.
Well, I want to offer condolences to you and the Virginia Beach community. I'm wondering what you can tell us about how people are holding up. I understand you visited a hospital where some of the people wounded in the shooting are being treated still.
I did. You know, this is, again, it's a horrific tragedy, and our hearts go out to certainly the 12 victims that showed up for work yesterday for the city of Virginia Beach intending to go home, and this tragedy occurred, and they weren't able to. And so there's a tremendous void in their families and our community right now. There's a lot of hurt and healing that needs to take place. I was able to go to the hospital this morning. My intentions were twofold. I wanted to thank the caregivers, the doctors, the nurses, and the administrators. And then also I was able to speak with one of the patients and the families, and they're just such strong and faithful people and just going through what must be one of the hardest experiences in their life. They were just very grateful for the care that they were receiving and grateful for the heroic work of the law enforcement agents yesterday.
Inevitably, after each mass shooting, there are calls for tighter gun laws. You introduced a number of gun control bills in Virginia's General Assembly back in January, not even 6 months ago.
Yes.
Most of them were voted down, including a proposal to let localities ban guns in government buildings like the one where this shooting took place. Do you see any likelihood of political action in the Republican-controlled General Assembly?
Well, Don, it's unfortunate that we have to have these tragedies to, you know, even have the dialogue regarding common sense gun legislation. As you just said, I introduced several pieces of common sense gun legislation both years that I've been governor, and they were defeated on the first day of the session. So this is something that I will continue to support. I will continue to explore our options. But, you know, as we say, actions speak a lot louder than words, and I will have the leadership that's needed, but I will ask my fellow legislators to explore these options as well. And, you know, at the end of the day, we need to make sure that Virginia is safe, that our communities are safe, our schools, our movie theaters, our municipalities, like what occurred yesterday. This is, you know, this is something that these tragedies have become all too familiar, and we cannot let ourselves become desensitized to this. We must do what the people are asking to do, and that is to move forward and make sure that our communities are safe.
I'd like to ask you about the coming days and how you and other officials are going to help people in your state move forward.
Well, you know, there are so many agencies and men and women that are giving of their time to, right now, Don, help these families. I mean, it's just a tremendous tragedy, and they've lost their loved ones. And you know, we have funerals to prepare for. We have, you know, the ongoing business of Virginia Beach that needs to continue. We have a lot of friends and co-workers of these individuals that, you know, that we're helping them with counseling. There have been a number of prayer vigils here in Virginia Beach. I attended one this morning, and those will certainly continue. But, you know, as we say, occurrences like this, it takes a village, and we just have a very strong and faithful village here in Virginia Beach that's going to try to heal as we move forward.
We've been talking to Ralph Northam. He's Virginia's Democratic governor. Governor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Don.
Context of white supremacy. The Coon Man dominating 2019. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, June 1, 2019, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have questions, observations, counter-racist suggestions you would like to offer. The number 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things before we get started. We are listener supported. Counter Racist Radio Invest. If you think the program is constructive, visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. Much obliged to all the folks who have invested a decade plus. Thanks so much for keeping the broadcast rolling. Hopefully we have been worthy of your time and energy. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email. We'll get you a physical mailing address. In addition to PayPal mailing something, you can also use Amazon. My wish list is linked under Gus T. Renegade at Amazon.com. It is also linked at the blog right beneath the PayPal button. Again, tremendous gratitude to all the investors who have nabbed items from the wish list over the past 10 years. Hopefully the cows has provided accurate, constructive information on what it means to be white, what white supremacy racism is, and things that non-white people victims of racism can and should be doing to solve this problem ASAP. Additionally, the COWS 10-year anniversary counter-racist yoga retreat. We did round one in the Coon Man's state, Virginia, looking to do round two in California. Labor Day weekend, the dates, August 29, that is a Thursday to Sunday, September 1, 4 days, 3 nights, counter-racist activity, yoga in the morning, yoga in the evening, plant-based meals every day, all day. Chef Nadira flying out from VA to prepare the meals and to give us some counter-racist food workshops. We had Dr. Lathan on the program, just gave us all that great information this past week on Wednesday, I think it was. Chef Nadira covered some of the same topics in showing how you can prepare meals and different strategies you can do use to prepare meals at the beginning of the week and that sort of thing. And you can ask questions, certainly, but all of that, again, August 29 through September 1. Drop an email if you are interested in registering the sign-up. So next Sunday, not tomorrow, but next Sunday, June 9, the deadline, if you want to sign up, the deposit, $400 by next Sunday. Final portion, $375, would be due the first week in August. That is all-inclusive, room and board, yoga, counter-racist workshops, no mud. Again, untiljustice@gmail.com, drop an email if you would like to register, sign up, need more information about the retreat. Next, I super appreciated the StoryCorps report where the black male victim of racism was discussing the impact of his father, and his father coming to support him at his athletic contests, and his father helping him with his homework and staying up all night to learn a subject, algebra, that he wasn't his strongest, so that he could help his child, getting it up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I contrast that to the new American classic, The Hate U Give, which is allegedly about showing some gratitude for black fathers and some appreciation for the work that they do. In that small little, 4 minute audio snippet, just with a black male talking about, his dad helping him with his homework and coming to support him at, hostile, racist high school athletic contests, heard all about that in sundown towns. I felt more genuine appreciation for attempted black fathers than in the entire text of The Hate U Give, which is supposed to be about, that's supposed to be a central theme, appreciation for black male dads. Next, the segment where they were talking about the racist places, it was called Nigger Hill, Negro Hill, now it's Freedom Hill. I would support them switching it back to Nigger Hill in India, and there's lots of that. That's in sundown towns as well. James Lowen, that's the book club every Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Lots of constructive info. He has a whole section. I almost took a snippet from the book to preface that audio report in Lowen's book, where he talks about how they would purge the black people from a particular area, and then they would put them in, wherever on the outskirts, and they would brand the new place for the exiled black people. They would call that Niggertown, Niggerville, names like that. That was very common throughout. He mentions that several times in the text, and having these types of names, Nigger Cliff, Nigger Ridge, Nigger Hill, that is not just a U.S. thing. If you go way back in the Cal's archive to 2011, Dr. Ann Patel Gray was with us live from Australia. And I got my books now. I bet I could probably put my hand on it. She has a map in the book that shows Australia, and they have the same thing. Nigger River, Three Nigger Hill, that sort of thing, all across the continent of Australia. Same thing. Global system of white terrorism. Next, speaking of Cal's archives, so the segment on Walt Whitman, I had to play it. So many reasons I had to play it. I'm sure we have some listeners, regardless of your age group, you are required to study or learn, read, recite perhaps even some Walt Whitman while you were in school, undergrad, high school, elementary, kindergarten, somewhere in there, I suspect. Anywhere in the world, I suspect. Second, reading is more important than watching television, the grandcester. However, Mr. Fuller and many others have said, you can learn a lot about white supremacy racism watching television. Any television, really. What I have maintained for years, one of the best programs that is all about white supremacy racism, Breaking Bad, the main character is Walter White, and they make Walt Whitman a central aspect of the plot of one of the most successful television programs of all time, even though it's been off the air for 6 years now. What I prefaced the audio report on Walt Whitman was from a sound clip from Breaking Bad, where they actually have a pause from the script to have a recital of Whitman's poetry. And as I said, that Walt Whitman is an integral aspect of the plot, in addition to his name being almost identical to the main character. In that audio segment from New York Public Radio, they mentioned a Northwestern student who was failed in a class because he refused, a graduate's class, to be specific, was failed because he refused to recite Walt Whitman. That student, victim of white supremacy, was Timothy McNair, guest on The Context of White Supremacy. I tweeted out that episode from the archives where you can go back and hear in detail how he learned about Mr. Whitman. We read some of Mr. Whitman's views on niggers because he doesn't say views on race. In the segment, the suspected white man doing the interview, he kept saying consistently, well, what were views on race? What were Whitman's thoughts on race? What did he have to say about race? He didn't call him a racist, and he didn't say what were his thoughts on black people. He could have been real explicit and accurate to what Whitman said, his thoughts on niggers. What were his thoughts on niggers? Because that's the word he used. He never said, let me tell you my thoughts on race. He said, let me tell you why I think the niggers should have stayed in slavery. That's what we're talking about. Be explicit. Now, she did say, Rebecca Carroll, the victim of racism who was being interviewed, she did say, oh, yeah, Whitman did compare black people to baboons, but I mean, it's a lot more than that. And they waited a long time to even bring out those details in the segment. They spent much more time talking about, oh, this guy is worse, Walt Whitman, and his place in American literature. And, oh, man, it would have been great if Malcolm X could have had time to sit in the grass and think. And that is burying the lead, as they say. We are supposed to be talking about Walt Whitman and racism. Why are we having to wait halfway through the report before we even get to that? And even then, they still obscure it. They move and start talking about another victim of racism who wrote a report imagining Walt Whitman to be an abolitionist, even though that, too, is not accurate to the record, where he did, in fact, write about helping a white man sell a slave. That would be true. Not let's try to reconfigure and imagine, fabricate a world where Walt Whitman didn't think of black people as incompetent niggers and didn't want us to stay in slavery. Let's try to imagine something else. That sort of thing is so dangerous. I feel whites do that the evidence shows whites do that on a regular basis, where they pretend, practice racism. They're being deceptive, make it seem like they are reporting, sharing truthful information about racism and even involve other victims, non-white people in this production, but it's not sharing truthful information at all. They obfuscate, they move away from it. They don't even use accurate terms to describe what's being talked about here. And they could have even said, yeah, Walt Whitman was a racist. It's undeniable. The AP just had that. Let's not pussyfoot. According to the evidence, he was a racist even by his peer standards. There were whites of that time period who didn't think that black people should have been, quote unquote, slaves. So if that's true, the question would be, well, why is he still so revered and that's not attached to racism? Or is the fact that he's so celebrated is a part of that because of racism? Is that why he would get a whole poem read in Breaking Bad? Those would be better questions, in my opinion, as opposed to kind of pussyfooting, minimizing Whitman's dedication to white supremacy and then moving off to other projects and quoting confused victims. Next, the case where they talked about in Federal Way, there's two black males. There's a car accident, and the two black males, they were at a gas station. They went to go help. They were clearing debris from the road, and then they ended up getting choked out and all of that. Federal Way is about approximately 20 miles south of Seattle, give or take. It's not very far. You can get there roughly 30 minutes, depending on traffic time of day. It's not very far. I think they said the officer who choked out one of the black males, that now he's a longshoreman here in Seattle. It's not. They're very, very close. You can catch one city bus from Seattle to Federal Way. It's not very far. That report, I mean, there's number one, if you're out at night, I think we've had many people who have talked about, do you intervene? Now, this was a car accident. People have presented this in terms of intervention. Do you intervene if there's a fight, if a white person's attacking a black person, that sort of thing? I think Mr. Fuller, other folks have said, it's a lot to consider. If this was not your plan to get involved with something, like, wow, things can go drastically wrong. You have no idea. All it could take is one white person to show up. Doesn't even have to be an enforcement official. One white person to show up, and things can go drastically wrong. Traffic accident, alcohol involved, talk about sobriety. You go to assist the enforcement officers, and somehow now you are a suspect in all of this. You are being treated, or it's not even treated. You end up getting choked out and arrested in all of this. Wow. I can only say it's a whole lot to consider if you're going to be out. And I think that's one of those why Dr. Kanban suggests not being out late at night, because that sort of thing can happen so easily. Even if they hadn't got involved, let's say they had just stayed in the car, stayed in their vehicle, right? The accident happens. Whoa, can you believe that? That's crazy. They try and pull out a leave. The cops could have stopped them. You saw something. Wait here. We're going to get a story from you. You look suspicious. Are you under the influence? System of racism, white supremacy, that sort of thing happens all the time. The enforcement officials going in, it was reported to go in and ask the attendant, do you want to trespass them from the station and all of that? I guess I can only say ask. I mean, it's a tough situation all the way, but maybe ask if you can access your vehicle. That seems like the type of situation where the officers were looking to terrorize, just looking for an opportunity to terrorize these victims. So if it's one of those situations, you just try to do the best you can, but maybe try asking. That way you can let them know directly. And I mean, they can still do whatever they're going to do, but horrible situation all the way around. They were charged with obstructing officers. I point out that that happened very close to Seattle. There was an article in the Seattle newspaper 2007. I remember the year specifically because this was 1 year before the cows came into existence. I was on the University of Washington campus, and there was a white enforcement officer who walked by. He heard, I was with a group of non-white people, they were talking about racism. He stopped to talk to them briefly, and then he left. I saw him again later the same day, and he stops. Now he wants to talk a lot about racism. This white man, he confesses. People call me every day, all the time. Oh my goodness, there's a black fella down there. You got to go do something. And he says, he'll be like, well, what's he doing? He says, I just told you, there's a black fella down there. You need to go get him. He says, this happens all. And he got super. He placed a great deal of emphasis. This was not one of those, oh, yeah, I deal with that about once a week. This was, oh, man, this is every day I deal with. That was the way that he conveyed it, like with that much emphasis. And he said it multiple times with emphasis. This is every day that, you know, black fella there, not a black person looking like they're looking in vehicles, not a black person with a crowbar looking like they're doing something suspicious, just walking on the sidewalk. You need to go get him. And he says he'll try and explain to him, well, if the person's not doing something illegal or suspicious, I mean, niggers can walk. I mean, that's not reason. He alleges this is what he tells them, but he said this. We've been having this long discussion about racism. The very next day, the article comes out in the paper about black people being, it was an article in the Seattle newspaper about black people being disproportionately charged with obstructing officers. And we had just in that same conversation, the white officer had just said, you say something, you smirk. In fact, the title of the report that I played from Federal Way was that these two black males had defiant smiles. I can post the report if you want to read, but that's what it was titled, Defiant Smiles. But the white officer in Seattle, he was saying, oh, yeah, same thing Norm Stamper said. Oh, yeah, you looked at him. You didn't walk fast enough. Looked like you weren't getting your wallet out quick enough. Anything like that, much less you made a, snide remark, sound like you were trying to be an uppity Negro. Like, oh, yeah, obstruction of justice. That'll be enough to get discretion. My word, discretion, major one, but all of that came to mind with the report. It was not lost on Gus T. They alleged in the report that these two victims, they went to this convenience store to get a cigar. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Getting a cigar is not a crime, nor is that a reason to be choked out. Speaking of choked out, words are important. They didn't say that the suspected race soldier used a chokehold. They called it a lateral vascular neck restraint. That is precise, codified language. Victims of white supremacy, that should be our goal. We are striving to be as precise, effective with the use of words. Lateral vascular neck restraint. It sounds so scientific. It sounds so professional. You're not a goon going out choking someone out. This is your last breath, nigger. Remember how Norm Stamper used to say, got my nigger knocker, got my nigger choker? No, this is a lateral vascular neck restraint. You see, we've had the finest physicians, the coon man, come in and show us the best way to get someone to black out. Let me show you. Skillful use of words. That expertise, being able to use language to suggest or convey competence. Oh, sparkling illustration. Next. In that report, the same report about Federal Way, the officers at the convenience store, they said that this officer who has a history with the lateral vascular neck restraint, they said that he also has a history of conducting searches without a warrant. I think some moron is known for saying, hey, you need to make sure you are not being searched without a warrant. You don't say it as though you got an army behind you. You don't want to be placed in a lateral vascular neck restraint. You want to calmly say, sir, ma'am, I do not consent to searches of my person, property, residence, or vehicle without a warrant. Even if he handcuffs you, hope he doesn't choke you out, even if he handcuffs you and does the search anyway, that can come up in court the same way that you heard right there. I did not agree to this search. I did not consent, and he did not have a warrant. This should be thrown out, and that is exactly what happens sometimes, even with victims. Next, the Central Park Five, I guess I'll ask on that one if anyone has been on Netflix to see that Ava DuVernay's series. I have not. I only ask because there's already a documentary on the Central Park Five. Sarah Burns, who is also a guest on The Context of White Supremacy 2012. You can go back in the archives. She actually was a guest in between. Sarah Burns has a book on the Central Park Five, which I have read. The book was published. We talked about that when she came on the program. Her visit was before her film was released. So I had not seen the documentary, and I actually still have not seen that documentary, even though I own it. But there already is a project. I just thought that was, it reminded me of what I've said about it becoming a genre, the death of black people, necrophilia, even though the Central Park Five, these black males weren't killed, but still to make, and this is not a documentary. This is like a docudrama, to make a dramatized series on Netflix about black males being falsely accused of rape as children and convicted, incarcerated, to make a kind of TV show type thing about this, even though they said it was the victim's request, at least some of them. That was not something that I was excited about. I didn't know how to feel about that. I'll ask how other folks feel. With that, this is the only broadcast where I request that we not use metaphors. They used quite a few in the segments, as they normally do. Colorblind, race blind, all of those are metaphors and dangerous metaphors. Again, they obfuscate. They're hiding from the truth. And racists, in my view, they do that on a regular basis. They will use metaphors, analogies, similes, these comparisons to deliberately generate confusion. They will compare two entities and insist that they are equal, identically the same, and frequently they are not. This happens on a regular basis. Victims, myself included, we are still learning. We've been exposed to this misconduct for centuries. And many of us, we are still learning. As such, there are times where we are lacking logic to articulate our views. As such, we'll substitute and incorporate a metaphor or comparison of some sort. If we could make an effort to strive for precision, lateral vascular neck restraint, precision, constructive precision with words. That's what we're striving for. If we cannot be exact, specific with what we would like to say, please take a little bit more time so that we can articulate ourselves in the best way possible. No metaphors. I will prompt about that. Thank you kindly. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, questions, suggestions, that would be grand. That way everybody will get at least one chance to share. We should have ample time if you have additional questions or thoughts that you would like to provide. The number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I will only say again, it is the year of the Coon Man. In February, we were planning for the Cows Yoga Retreat in Virginia. There were calls for him to resign. The Lieutenant Governor Fairfax was polishing up his speech, becoming only the second Negro governor in the history of the Commonwealth, and we are not even 4 months removed. All of that has been forgotten. The investigation is done. Justin Fairfax is almost the one that is fighting off rape allegations. And no one is talking about the Coon Man leaving. In fact, the Coon Man is out saying that he is going to help the state of Virginia heal and get through this. The shooting, not him being the Coon Man and a racist, but we're going to heal and get through this together. Now let's all hold hands and we'll remember the great Negro entertainer Michael Jackson. We'll get to folks, *61, if you have comments, thoughts you would like to share. People should pay serious attention to the Virginia shooting. Some of the victims in that case were black, so at least a few months to try to get more details on who the black victims were. Everybody, really, but particularly black victims in the Virginia shooting. That might be worthwhile. If you got any constructive details you would like to share, I would certainly be interested. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, oh, ma'am. Goodness. She waited until the Toronto Raptors were in the finals for Drake to annoy the world to call in and say, oh, yes, now I want to represent for Toronto and give my counter-racist views as we're about to take our glory and win the basketball championship. Be in Toronto. Yes, ma'am. We can hear you live.
Hi, Gus. How are you?
Quite poorly.
Yes, yes, I understand. With the system of white supremacy still being a major problem, but I think I have some solution around this. In fact, I was reading a book. It's called The Gentle Art of Verbal Self-Defense at Work. And I know that on your show, you do speak about understanding terminology and using terminology effectively. I also wanted to add that the use of body language and how body language is conveyed is also something that's going to be crucial as well. And the reason why I'm mentioning this is I actually had a demonstration of that yesterday. Yesterday I was on a visit with a colleague of mine who is a white female, and while we were speaking with an applicant, she would occasionally turn to me while she's speaking. So her intonation, her voice intonation, was calm right through, and she would occasionally be laughing and smiling. But when she turned to me, because she would voice her frustration with the applicant that we were speaking with. And the applicant was sitting right beside her, understands English, and it just baffled me. I couldn't understand how the person wasn't able to latch on to what she was actually doing. She even used a profanity during that time. So it was an interesting lesson. So this is what I read from the book here. It says that we human beings want to believe that if we say the right words, we've done all that we can reasonably expected of us. Never mind how much this sounds like the standard party line for primitive magic. Just get your incantations right and they'll always work. We still want to believe it because we know that it's relatively easy to improve our words. However, the support, the support given to those words is needed by body language, including tone of voice and intonation, making them more powerful than they would be otherwise. The meaning conveyed by your body language is much more powerful than the meaning conveyed by your words. So in other words, while we're being distracted by what appears to be a calm demeanor, calm intonation of the voice, the word somehow our minds are not really capturing the message of what's really being said. And by reading this book, it helped me make the connection as to why when the applicant was actually sitting beside her and she actually made a profanity about the applicant to me while laughing and smiling, that he didn't recognize as such. I mean, if she had changed her intonation, if it looked a little more congruent, then he would have been able to pick up. So I also recognized that this strategy was an effective use of deception as well. So just to keep that in mind. The other thing that I had noticed too is to always be aware of proximity and your space. I know that this has been mentioned before, especially in the work environment. So I'm sure that neutralizing workplace racism has this topic has come up. But another thing I've observed is if to increase surveillance, they do what I have now termed as the boxing in method, where they have a white colleague like literally around you as if you're surrounded. So if you have an opportunity where a desk is not actually assigned to you, you have that opportunity to, what I would suggest is to start moving around if you can, to break that boxed in, setup. Also I wanted to add, because I know that there was a piece about, Sutton, Ontario. I'm very familiar with the York region, as well as I'm familiar with the Durham region. Sutton, Ontario used to be a sundown town, as well as many other suburbs out of the around the Greater Toronto area. So yes, I just wanted to add that racism is, well, racism is everywhere, and it's not surprising that it's there. There's very few Black people living outside of Toronto, and this is hence the reason. It's like a reservation within the city, because that's where most of the Black population is in Ontario. It's very rare that you'll see a Black family outside of Toronto because of the racism and because a lot of those places were sundown towns. So, you know, if they ever wanted to do, say, a lockdown, it would be quite easy to do so. Just shut down the highways and you're basically locked in the city. Which is very strategic on the white supremacist part. So I also wanted to add that in. Thank you very much. I'll leave the line.
Much obliged, B in Toronto. Thank you so much for the book. I was flipping through to see if I could find it. The Gentle Art of Verbal Self-Defense at Work, because it's similar to some other titles that we've dealt with books. But I just flipped through and was looking at the content section to see what some of the chapters are. Like, oh, this looks like something that I should read, or maybe we should read on the book club for the cows. And I scroll all the way down. They have a whole section on language. I keep scrolling down, and they have, oh, there it is, Chapter 9, Metaphors, A Brief Review. And they have a whole section that just deals with metaphors. But it looks like a lot of this book is just about using words and being mindful. It has a whole chapter on lying in the workplace. Like, this looks extremely constructive for folks' workplace racism. The author is Suzette Hayden Elgin. The title again, The Gentle Art of Verbal Self-Defense at Work. Much obliged for the book suggestion. Be in Toronto, reading more important than watching television. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, may I be heard?
Greetings, Irie in Louisiana. Greetings, Irie. Are you there? Not hearing you?
Hello.
Oh, okay. I can hear you now.
Hello. Oopsie daisy. Salutations, everyone, and Gus. I'm going to make this short. I can't watch the movie about the Central Park Five. I literally felt the blood pressure in my eyes increasing when I was watching the trailer with someone and had to leave out of the room. It made me physically ill for a brief moment in time. So I suppose there's supposed to be a constructive value on the part of Mr. Vernet creating the film. But for me, I feel as though it is programming for people who classify themselves as white to say, yes, this is what we do. Black people are falsely accused all the times of crimes. We incarcerate them for major periods of time. And then we call ourselves giving them some type of recompense by paying them for things that can't be restored, such as their life and their time and the trauma that they've incurred. I think what would be most constructive if there was a movie about all the times that people classify themselves as white were penalized when they falsely accused people and what their lives were as a result. I think that would be better messaging in the motion picture or entertainment activity. If there's a serious effort to end racism, white supremacy. I do recall also blood chokes being mentioned in my time in the military. And they called them blood chokes and not the lateral vascular hold or restraint, because they made an inference that that particular hold will kill, as it has Mr. Garner. And I want to say rest in peace to Erica Garner as well. And then the next thing is in an attempt to self-soothe and deal with racism as best I can, and also help other people deal with it as best as they can. I'm starting a series with a woman who is not white, she's black, and she has vast information on the comedic gods and goddesses. And some people here may know or some of those deities. I'm learning about them, just learning about it myself. It's highly interesting. For instance, there's a goddess called Bastet, which is a black cat. And this deity, this goddess, is known to be the destructor of chaos. So I found that interesting because all my life coming up, it was like black cats are bad luck, black, you know. And I'm like, how interesting is that? You know, we've been taught that it's bad luck when it's actually quite the opposite, and I'm considering myself a student of this lady, but also, you know, just trying to help others as I learn. So we came together with a series where she's teaching, again, this knowledge on ancient knowledge from Kemet, and I am an introductory series on how to counter racism, you know, minimizing contact with the guidance of Mr. Fuller's books. And also, you know, Dr. Amos, Dr. Francis Cresswell, and rest in peace to both of them, and other historical literature that I read along the way, because I do read a lot of anthropology and history in American, antebellum America. And so it's helping me deal with it in a more objective way, even though I still, again, get emotionally disturbed by what I see and hear. And thank you to the previous caller about that book. I also read a book on body language. It's called I Can Read You Like a Book. So that may be something other people want to pick up along with that as well. They understand us more than we understand ourselves. They know, you know, our physical reactions and facial reactions. And, you know, it's important that we understand it as well as they do, too, so we can better control ourselves, our minds, and our bodies. And I'll mute my line. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you, Gus.
Thank you, Irie. Congratulations on your new series. We need more victims of racism not being spectators. Get out and put that counter-racist information to use. Other folks who dialed in, *61, if you have commentary to share. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. I'll just start off. South Florida, quite a few tragic things that has happened in this area. I'll start off with one in which I'll start off with two black males, ages 5 and 6, biological brothers, who drowned in the swimming pool that's in the apartment complex where they reside. There's a reasoning on why I'm mentioning this particular situation is because one of the reasons why non-white black people in this part of the world don't have a high level of swimming ability is due to the global system of racism, white supremacy. I hear talking in the background. Do you hear it, Gus?
I don't hear anything now.
Okay, I don't either. Okay, continuing on. due to, as we were discussing in Sundown Town on how the racist military-like way remove non-white black people away from seashores, in close proximity to other water resources, and in turn it retards the ability to have interest in the water as well as recreational activities that you can attach yourself with. From that idea, I thought it would be a good idea to try to incorporate into the DCS program. I would say every other session, a swimming class for the fellas We have a large group, so it has to be sanctioned to whereas a correct amount of instructors would be able to supervise the entire group. I knew a guy personally, a former co-worker for Dade County Fire Department that taught my son how to swim. He's an excellent teacher, very patient person, very calm person, and I'm pretty sure after we make the arrangements that he'll get the job done pretty well. We have children as young as 7 years old, boys especially, because of their aggressive and energetic behavior. It can get to a situation to whereas, you know, children in general are interested in water that may not be afraid of it until they get to a point where the water's over their head and they have the inability to remain on the surface of the water. Also, another tragic event took place where three black males were killed due to a car slamming into them. There is a nutty person that it says sobriety is best. The driver of the vehicle, this happened about 5 o'clock in the morning, was inebriated and slammed into these three non-white black males. Ages range from 15 to 13, I believe. All three of them reportedly were destined to be the first members of their families to go to college. It was reported. The person who did it was drunk driving. So therefore, you know, as you state over and over again, sobriety is the best choice to make. And also non-aggressive driving, too, on top of it. Yes, as far as, well, I mentioned about the DCS program, we met today also. And as I mentioned before, I made arrangements with Mr. Reddick on getting the swimming lessons in. And that's it's just about it for today as far as the week is concerned. That's all I have to say for right now. Thank you.
Much obliged. Sobriety would be best. I think I might have heard that once or twice. Those vehicle accidents cause a lot of problems for non-white people worldwide. Condolences to those who lost their life. Those swimming deaths, we talked about that a lot as well. There's a lot of information on that as well with black children just not getting the same type of safe access to swimming areas. I think that's in Richard Williams' book as well. He talked about that, where you would have a lot of black children every summer who would end up dying from those unsafe swimming conditions throughout the system of racism. So another problem to be mindful of. Much obliged, retired firefighter. Other folks who dialed in that we have missed thus far, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Robbie Hunt.
Greetings, Thomas, in New York.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the firefighter and all other callers. As you know, Gus, I got your back. And I had a few things I wanted to report on. Ironically, this week in London, a worker who blackened up as a minstrel cleared of racism. This guy came to work in the Christmas party in blackface, and they brought him to court for racism. And he was cleared. I put a coon in when I saw that article. That article was in, it was in the Times.co.uk. But I thought that
Fourier Celeste, he declared a racism. So it really didn't matter anyway. Jesse got his job back. Also in the UK, I thought this was interesting. Broken blackface, I guess you could call this reverse blackface. I don't want to use a metaphor. But, children whitening skin to avoid racism as hate crimes against minors rise. Children as young as 10 are whitening their faces to avoid being subjugated to racist abuse in Britain. A child protection group has warned as police struggle to stem a rising tide of hate against children. A total of 10,571 racially motivated hate crimes against children, an average of 29 per day, were recorded by police between a 12-month period of 2017 to 2018. And I thought that was very interesting because I said, well, maybe this is happening to, they say, against race. Maybe it's happening to Muslims, but no, they have a whole other category for religion, another category for LGBT. So it wasn't Arabs, it wasn't Muslims, it wasn't Jews. This is particularly black people in the UK. And then at a total of 71,251 were recorded between England and Wales in between that 12-month period. And I thought that was very interesting because we see the same spike after 2016 here in racist crimes against black people. Now I watched this docuseries. It's a four-part docuseries on the Wu-Tang Clan, a rap group from New York City. Came on Showtime. The racism was embedded in the story. I was just watching it because I was a fan growing up. In high school, they were like one of the biggest groups. I went to a few of their concerts. And they were talking about Staten Island in the early 80s going to school. And Staten Island doesn't have a lot of black people as opposed to the other boroughs. However, Staten Island is pretty big. It's larger than the city of Atlanta. I mean, it's not a small place, but not a lot of black people. They said that people in their 30s, white men in their 30s, would chase them home from school when they were 9 and 10 years old. I mean, I thought it was very interesting. I said, man, Gus could make a bunch of sound clips just out of this one little segment. But I guess that's, what, fourth and fifth grade? And they're running home from school because they lived in the projects. And they had to walk through this all-Italian white area to get to school. So in the morning, I guess they got to school pretty safely. But coming home, they had to plot how they were going to get home every day. I listened to the clip on the Ghetto Boys. And, you know, just a different perspective, looking back in hindsight, the Mind Playing Tricks on You song. Ghetto Boys from the Fifth Ward of Houston. Head artist was Mr. Scarface. And I was a fan. I had the tape. I bought it because of that song. And I had Scarface albums. And I wouldn't consider them the first emotional rappers. You know, I would say, you know, Slick Rick or LL probably, but in the interview, I think it would have took a whole different perspective or a whole different direction, rather, if they would have played the actual song, played the non-edited version of the song, because they were rapping about the stress and paranoia from being drug dealers. And I'm listening to the song play, and I'm like, oh, man, they're playing the video version, you know, but I mean, four walls just staring at a nigga. I'm paranoid sleeping with my finger on the trigger. You know, the other verse with my man Willie D. Is it the fool that I ran off the block? Or is it the nigga last week that I shot? Or is it the one I beat for $5,000? Thought he had cane, but it was gold medal flower. know, laughing about cheating people and shooting people, black people. I mean, I would be paranoid too, you know. But I think that this is, looking back in hindsight, just one of many songs that glorified a lifestyle that landed millions of our people in behind prison bars and in an early grave. And I don't think a lot of this stuff was constructive. I don't think a lot of the music today is constructive, but they're not killing each other in every song. The Young Turks clip, and this is the last thing I was going to add, whites get off hearing and talking about all the powers, they call it privileges, that they have. But the one thing they love doing more than that is to talk about all the abuse that black people take. I mean, he was like, my favorite story was, you know, the one who was, you know, I mean, it was like, you know, how's that your favorite story? Like, it was the best part, you know, he was happy to see it. And I hate when they do that. I find that a trend of white people. They love to talk about the abuse that they give to us and that we enact on each other as a result of what they do to us. And I have more to add later, but I'll meet myself, Dustin.
There was a question for you that was raised in workplace racism yesterday, Thomas in New York, Stacy in the UK. She asked, you told us about your previous place of employment, workplace racism, Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. She asked, you told us about the situation where they accused you of stealing the produce funds. Embezzling the produce funds. She said, hindsight, given what you know now, would you have done anything differently, knowing what you know now and how you dealt with purchasing the fruit or handling that money, anything in that process? Is anything you would have done differently that you think may have helped protect you from the racists at your former job?
Man, contemplating on it. I was put in a situation where I could have went to the supermarket and got a receipt, which was my initial plan, but I was told to go to the food stand where the guy, just a non-English-speaking guy who sells food. So I'm pretty much in a position where I can't fool it. You know what I'm saying? I could only fool what I buy from the supermarket, which is certain items that they want. But everything else I'm supposed to get from this other guy, and he has no way of, you know. So, in that respect, as far as the guy who I worked with, you know, looking back in hindsight, I would have treated him much differently, because I probably would have looked at him much more suspiciously. But that's about it, though. It's one of those things that it was terrible for a week, and it got much, much better, you know, to me. I'm in a much better situation as far as stress, dealing with stress. You know, most of the people that work at this place I work at, it's a lot of white people, of course, but it's a lot of non-white people, too. They're just not black, you know what I'm saying? So I'm not alone, but I'm alone, you know what I'm saying? I meet myself, Gus. Thank you. And I did have more to add earlier. I'm later on it.
Oh, okay. Much obliged. I'm sure Stacy appreciates that in the UK. Any other folks who dialed in that we've missed totally, if you have a comment to share? If we've missed you totally, proceed. Folks who dialed in with a hand up that we missed totally.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. This is Ken Steele. I'm calling from Los Angeles. And I got a few things to report. Earlier this week, I saw something pretty interesting. There was some sort of event going on held at some local store by some streamer named Adam22, and he runs some podcast or a web broadcast that's primarily aimed towards younger listeners of rap music. And I'm not young at all. Well, I guess some people would consider me young, but I don't think I'm like young in a hip hop sense. I'm not like 16 or anything like that. So I'm pretty, at this point in my life, far removed from what would be called hip hop culture. I guess contemporary hip hop culture as what kids are listening to. And one thing I noticed about the crowd that was gathered there was that something that it seemed like a consistent theme was there was a lot of Mexicans that were using the N-word. They were saying, and I use the N-word, I really don't feel comfortable saying it when it's not necessary to be said. I think everybody understands what I'm referring to, but yeah, they just seemed alarmingly cool about using the N-word in colloquial speech and in raps. And most of the freestyling that I heard that day was pretty embarrassing, considering all of the bad remarks I hear about Black people and their freestyling. I heard a lot of white and Mexican freestylers, and it was just not impressive at all. And then another thing that I wanted to touch on is, the facts surrounding the recent shooting in Virginia, they seem to be hard to come by, and they seem to be very deliberate in the way that they're disseminating this information. For example, when these shooters turn out to be white, I noticed that if there is any sort of military service that they have, they're quick to be able to give you a full breakdown on their military service, and they'll even go ahead and give you diagnoses that they may have received at the VA. A lot of these mass shooters are often referred to as having PTSD whenever they have military service history. This person apparently was a military, an Army reservist, and I was looking up information. They weren't able to say if he was honorably or dishonorably discharged. I'm finding it hard to believe that the news would have trouble finding that information about this particular shooter. And then another thing that was interesting was that, to me, was that this shooter was recently fired from his job. And after listening to so many workplace racisms and, my own experiences in the workplace, I'm not saying that I would go ahead and gun down my old coworkers and everything like that, but I can definitely understand how the treatment one would receive at one of these jobs could result in somebody taking rather extreme and violent action, especially after a long and protracted firing period. Because anybody who listens to workplace racism knows that when you are let go from one of these jobs, it's usually a very long, drawn out, and sometimes physically painful in the form of stress process. So, I'm eager to hear more information about this shooting as it comes forward. If anybody has any more information about it, any sort of accounts, that would be very interesting. Also, the news has been the way that they've been reporting this. It's very peculiar to me. They seem to be taking steps to try to minimize the shooter. For instance, the photo that they used, I don't think that they were able to find a mugshot, and I don't think that they were able to find anything that looks incriminating in his past. So what they did, what I've been noticing, is that they're actually posting his high school photo in which he looks very similar. sorry. He looks very similar to the appearance that Steve Urkel used to have. And I think that that is, you know, very deliberate in the way that they're presenting this person, because they're so limited. It seems that there's a very limited amount of information that they're able to get on him. And it seems that all the information would suggest that he's an upstanding member of society, or he was an upstanding member of society prior to this attack. So, I'm just very, very curious to hear any more information. If anybody has any more details, that would be great. I'll go ahead and mute my line at this time. Thank you.
From the high school photograph that you've seen, do you think this is someone classified as white?
Oh, absolutely not. This is a black guy.
Oh, okay.
The shooter is definitely, no, the shooter is definitely black.
Okay.
The shooter is definitely black, and of the victims, I think three of them could be classified as black as well. One of them might not be black. I don't know. It might just be the photo that they selected was not brightened. So
I see.
I don't know.
The report that I saw, I would agree, Mr. Steele. In terms of information, now certainly this happened yesterday, so I suspect by the time we do the compensatory call in next Saturday, there should be a lot more information about this event. You know, they generally might say in the first 24 hours, sometimes the information is not the best. But the reports that I've seen, I've yet to see even that photograph that you talked about, the high school photograph, the written reports that I've seen, the Washington Post, and some even Virginia outlets, they did not have a photograph of the alleged shooter, Dwayne Craddock. They did have photographs of the victims at the Washington Post, and I saw the same thing, that it looked like about three of the victims looked like they would be classified as black. Everybody
Can
else...
I interject real quick?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Real quick? You know, it was very interesting when they did the way that they are releasing this, the information related to this report. This is the most codified I have seen the news react to a shooting by not using the shooter's name. I've heard, you know, reporters on a number that I can't count say something to the effect of, we won't be saying his name, or we won't be releasing the shooter's name after this broadcast. And then there's a deliberate attempt to not show his picture. And I just mentioned, the only picture that I see that the news is really running with is his high school photo. Now, I've seen more recent photos of him. And, you know, honestly, you know, he looks like an upstanding dude to me, other than the fact that he allegedly, you know, took out 11 people. But there isn't any photograph that would be incriminating. I'm sure if he had a mugshot on file, they would just be running that nonstop, and they would be talking about his past transgressions. And I think even in the news report that I read, they were going into his family history, and they didn't find any bad information there, but they had very specific information about his mother and her recent travel plans, and that was just all very peculiar to me. The only time I can recall somebody's relatives or next of kin and their travel plans being reported was during the Las Vegas shooting, where they reported that the shooter's girlfriend was visiting, I believe, the Philippines or some other place in Asia at the time of the shooting. So I'll go ahead and mute my line.
Much obliged. Other folks, if you have any additional information on the shooting in VA or other thoughts, any of the audio clips that we've heard this evening that you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers.
I wanted to put some focus on the use of words. But first, the panda segment, I think, on the albino affairs, I think that's also very interesting that I believe they said they got more infrared cameras, or they had them functioning more frequently, I guess, just to keep, I guess, to put attention on to the creature, the melanin deficient or the all-white panda bear. And I guess, because I did remember seeing a segment on it earlier in the week where I guess there hadn't been a birth of a albino panda, and they said it was red-eyed and everything. But I'm glad that you have that audio segment before the story that plays, because they do put greater emphasis on a life form that's not melanated and that has albinism. The next couple of things are the words that I've noticed that were used. There was a new segment about the they were using the word cheating scandal, and now it's changed to college admissions scandal. So they took the term cheating out, and that was just one example that I noticed. And there was a term that was used in the audio segment about the officer. I think the black male was Josiah Hunter, I believe. And they said the officer had a spotty. I think they mean S-P-O-T-T-Y. Had a spotty history or a spotty record. That could be another term, too, where it's like, I know I'm using the word light as though I'm about to mention a metaphor, but terms like stain and things like that sounds like it's going on that pattern where something of dark color is unfavorable, or something negative and bad. And on the segment with the Young Turks, they kept using the term KKK because of the people were calling the police or whatever. And it was saying, oh, well, you know, they're not KKK. Just because you're calling the police, I don't think that I'm KKK because I'm calling the police. No, it's just a misunderstanding. Kind of going on to the example of the folk-appointed racist, that you only have to be in that example. If you're outside of that example, then it's not all white people don't think that every white person is a suspected racist. And the Walt Whitman, like I thought about that last name, it almost sounds like it's white man, the last name, but the term wit, like intelligence or something of the mind, wits. It seems, I don't know the etymology of the last name, but like white plus wit, Whitman. I don't know if anyone noticed that, but that was something I was thinking of. And one last thing about words was there was a segment also on the news where a black couple, I guess, were on the way to the hospital to deliver a baby. And the term they used to introduce the segment was beautiful nightmare. So I don't know what that means, really. But it had to do with a black child being born. So interesting term that they used on that. And one last term I heard actually on the audio segment was cancellation culture. Cancellation culture. I guess it has something to do with the statues and things named after people who support the system of white supremacy. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. Important point about wit. I think whites do use that term regularly. Using your wit, your intelligence, as well as white man. I thought that all throughout the series of Breaking Bad, Walter, well, it's explicit there, Walter White, and then he loves Walt Whitman. The cancellation I thought was important as well, them even using such a term as that. Absolutely. Other folks who dialed in, I'll give out the number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate.
Hello, Gus, may I reply to him real quick about the term cancellation?
Let's hear it.
I don't know if it was just me, but I also felt like the reporter was almost in a way jeering at that. Like, yeah, there's a cancellation, quote-unquote, culture, but, you know, it seemed like it was something funny to her, like, oh, it really doesn't matter anyway. Did you pick that up, or did you pick that up, caller in Florida?
Caller in Florida?
I'm sorry, what was the question again?
It sounded like she was, like, making fun of it, even though she referenced it. It sounded like what I heard in her voice was almost like light jeering at it, like, oh, you know, there's cancel culture now, you know, but, like, in the back of her mind, it almost was like it doesn't really matter anyway, because, I don't know, it could be me.
I think it's also terms along with that words like, I think, is it called political correctness? I think that term has come up as well, where they'll use that to see where a victim of racism, how they will respond to it and see if they'll question it, because they might have a definition if the person might have asked it. Because I don't know who used the term first. Was that term used multiple times in that segment, or was it just once?
The term cancellation?
Cancellation culture, about the I think about the monuments and the statues and the people, or the names that been applied to statues and whatnot and buildings.
I think I heard it at least a couple times. I heard it at least, yeah, it was used more than once, I think, in the segment.
Oh, okay, because that's the first time I caught on to it, was toward the end, and I thought he had introduced it. I have to go back and hear it again, but I wanted to know what the definition of that was myself personally.
That is the
Thanks.
First. I'm sorry, Irene.
I was just saying thank you.
That's the first time that I've heard it used. I was curious about a definition myself. Other folks, if you have questions, suggestions, comments you want to share, line should be open.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada. She reminded me, I think Red is a former victim of Cheetos. She can set me right if I'm wrong. We did that program with Dr. Lathan on Wednesday. We talked about Cheetos. We talked about food, healthy diet, why it's so important to be mindful about what we put in our mouth. Truth. We wrap up the program. Non-white housemate, quietly downstairs, didn't disturb while we're doing the program. I walk downstairs. I kid you not. They are watching television with a bag of Cheetos on the table. I cracked up laughing. And some of them have listened to the program, have heard he had his pal over there. I think the game was that was Thursday. They were watching that. They were watching Drake and Toronto in the finals with a bag of Cheetos. What could be better? That's what probably you had millions of people doing, the exact same thing. Cheetos, watching the finals. That is the power. That is exactly what I said. That is another day where I chalk up a L. I couldn't even get the people in my own residence to not eat Cheetos. That is the power of racism, white supremacy, and the power of those addictives, the addictives in the Cheetos. Frito-Lay wins again. Thank you for your patience, Red in Nevada.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, used to love Cheetos and even dipping them in ranch, just horrible stuff. But just a few things, not really too many things on the cliffs besides the fact that I always have to refresh my memory when it comes to Walt Whitman. I don't really ever remember reading anything about him. I do remember reading, having to read stuff about like Mark Twain, but even when I was looking up different things about Walt Whitman and racism, it was basically the same thing, like was mentioned in the clip, where they would talk about, in the articles, they would talk about so many other things. And then finally, once you get towards the last, sometimes half or even third part of the article, that's when it would finally say, oh, well, he might have called black people baboons, or he might have had a different view on slavery after, or black people after, post-Civil War. There was even a few articles where it was referenced him as being queer because of something that he wrote about having some type of same-sex community or something like that. Just thought that that was interesting. Also with the Virginia Beach shooter, I haven't really heard too much about him either. And all I do, all I was able to actually look up as far as pictures was there was the high school one, and then there's like a black and white one that's like just a close-up of his face, but really nothing else. And I have been watching some documentaries, and there was one about a serial killer, and he definitely reminded me of Jeffrey Dahmer, except for the cannibalism. They did mention in the documentary where he was only going after black males, primarily because he killed, I think, about 23 or 30 people. And this was in Louisiana. So he killed them, I think, within like a five to 10 year period. And he also killed a few people even after Hurricane Katrina. But just the different deceptive ways of how he would get the victims. And they even said that some of the victims, they weren't even homosexual, and this white man, this racist, actually was. But I thought it was interesting how the families, some of the families, they were able to like speak on the documentary. And one family said that this one white man had killed five different people within their family. So either a cousin, a brother, a son, or what have you. But nowhere did they mention him as having like a hate crime, when they specifically said if he couldn't find a black male, then that's when he would just go ahead and get a white man. The other thing that the other documentary that I had watched was about Anthony Sowell, and he was the black male serial killer in Cleveland, Ohio, and he was the one who had murdered 11 black females. And it kind of, and just with the documentary, it was definitely, it didn't necessarily specifically speak about the racism, because as far as like the racism where that would be involved in the documentary is the fact that there were different family members reporting the black females as being missing, and they literally just didn't, the police department didn't do anything. But the main thing that made me think about the documentary is I was actually looking on Facebook and on the Cal's Facebook page, and I saw there was a receipt that said, it was blurred out, but I guess the name on the receipt was supposed to be nigga or something like that, and how the post was saying, well, you know, this is why we should not be eating out and whatever. But in the documentary, which I've never seen before, now the black victims, they were, if I'm not mistaken, most, if not all, were addicted to drugs. And they had in the documentary, they had one of the corner store owners. I don't know if he would be considered white, but he was from quote unquote Middle East. And he was actually allowed to say he wished that there was more Anthony Sowells. So that way he would be, because Anthony Sowell cleaned out the trash, which I thought was interesting, because the documentary was produced by a white woman. And with all the different things that I've seen, even on white women who were prostitutes, things like that, there was no one interviewed who was able to say something as despicable as what that individual said. So I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Red in Nevada. White women, integral component of the system of white supremacy, no doubt. Other folks that we missed totally have commentary they would like to share. We have less than 30 minutes left in the broadcast. If you think you would like to participate, folks left that we have not heard from at all. While folks are waiting to get their final thoughts together, Thomas in New York, I know you said you had additional comments you wanted to share. Do you want to go ahead and get your thoughts in while folks are waiting to get whatever other suggestions, comments they wanted to offer?
For sure, guys. So, one article I forgot to say, this came from WBUR, is systemic racism a public health crisis? Milwaukee says yes. So Milwaukee is saying now that racism that they're enacting on the black people is a public health crisis. So I'm very interested to see how they're going to go and tackle this public health crisis. I'm looking to that. What I wanted to talk about was this was in the Tribune, the Express Tribune, on Wednesday, May 29th. Samsung's new AI technology and create a video of anyone with a single picture. One single picture of you, it can make a video with you moving your mouth, saying things, with the voice recognition technology or sound just like you. Like now they can store up to 200 words in your voice that they can pretty much they say that's the vernacular of people. They could have a whole conversation with that. So they use the Mona Lisa as a test subject, and they actually have the Mona Lisa moving and moving her mouth and talking. And very interesting technology, especially since we know how this is used against us as black people. Another article that came out, something very similar, it's from The Big Picture. One of these models don't exist. So they have a picture of three people. I'm in a picture, three women, one of those makeup model shoots. And one of the three women are a computer-generated image, and it looks so real, you probably wouldn't be able to figure out which one of these are not the real person. And a lot of the images that we're seeing online and some of these computer-generated type of things, it's not even a real person. I didn't even realize this. These are computer-generated images of someone in a Maybelline or a Revlon shoot that you see on Pop Across YouTube or whatever. And I thought that was interesting as well. My wife graduated on Thursday from Lehman University in the Bronx, and I was very proud of her. I went to the graduation, and it was a very, nice ceremony. One thing that I did notice in my observation was it was a class of 3,600 people, which was a pretty big class, through all the different arts and sciences. It made up 3,600 people. And quite a large amount of people that would be classified as black. And afterwards, they had a little, everyone could stay on the campus. They served food and ice cream and things of that nature. And what I noticed was hardly none of the blacks would be classified as American blacks, and it was just very odd. And I'll mute myself, Gus. Thank you.
Congratulations to your wife. Reading is more important than watching television. I'm sure she had to do some reading to pull off that academic accomplishment. And I'm not surprised that you saw a lack of darker folks. That tends to be not by accident, but by deliberate planning, deliberate racist planning. Any other folks?
No, guys, they were darker folks. They just wasn't Americans.
Okay.
They were Yeah, it just wasn't, you know, black people that strong. You know, descendants of colonial system that was put in place here.
Gotcha. Not born in this part of the world. That, I think other folks have noted that trend as well. That's in sundown towns, too. He talked about that they would have black people that were born from someplace on the continent or what have you, but they would not dare have a black person that was born in Indiana or Michigan come to the school. Other folks, if you miss any, folks have additional comments, suggestions that they wanted to share.
Can I add one thing?
Red in Nevada.
There's been something that I've been kind of thinking about, and it's actually about the workplace. From time to time, we'll have to do these procedures, and one of the procedures was about, like, an active shooter, and I just keep comparing that, I guess, training or procedures or manual or whatever compared to some of the past plantations that I've been on, and basically they suggest, or they go over basically three options. One was to, like, try to run or get away. The other one was to hide. And then there was one, basically the last option was to fight. And I keep trying to think about just remember, like, any other training that I had. And I don't ever remember, like, fighting being an option. But they don't also go into, like, if you do so happen to fight, and if you are sued or something, because I've heard of, like, that happening even when people, if someone, like, breaks into your house, if you don't mortally wound them, they may be able to sue you for whatever reason. But I just thought that that was interesting, those three options that they basically give people on the plantation. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Mr. Steele.
Yes, a couple of things. One, as it relates to this shooter, I'm going to make a speculation that probably by this time next week, if they have not if the news media has not completely abandoned this story, they will go and find out more and more into this person's background. And there were a few things that kind of I think they'll go into this person's background and they'll go and report that he was some sort of what they're calling a red pill person, or somebody who subscribes to red pill ideology on the internet. And I'm making this speculation because of the reports that I have read about this situation, there was reports about his political affiliation and his online activity. There were some, murmurs or brief mentions of this. However, the news reports that I read said that the media is refraining from going into any more detail about these political affiliations pending investigation. And the way that they said that, I don't think that he was, you know, necessarily affiliated with any sort of what they call black identity extremists. I don't think that. I think this may be a red pill thing. Because one thing really stuck out to me was that they didn't mention that this person had any sort of romantic involvement with anybody or any sort of partner. In fact, his neighbors remarked that he never brought groceries home and he kept odd hours. Those were the only, strange things that they mentioned about him. So I think this may be a situation where it may be a guy who may have been triggered to take this route of action after protracted experiences of not having any sort of intimate relationships with anybody. I suspect that may be the case, and they're going to say that he was either an incel or a red pill movement person. And also, very recently, this just happened during the broadcast, but non-white, black boxer Anthony Joshua just lost to a very rotund Mexican fellow in a boxing match, and I'm very disappointed at this result as a Nigerian or a person whose family is from Nigeria. I'm embarrassed by this outcome. And finally, I was doing some reading on the internet, and some people were mentioning my participation on this broadcast. And some commenter mentioned that they recall that I mentioned that I may have been married and have twins. I'm not married. I do not have twins. I don't know where they got this information. I'm curious to know is if there have been times where people have called in pretending to be me. I don't think that could be the case, because I think my number shows up when I dial through. So I'm wondering if, you know, this may be incorrect information that's out there, or somebody might be calling in and imitating my voice. But no, I'm not married. I do not have twins. I'm not in a legally binding relationship with anybody. So I'm going to go ahead and mute my line at this point.
How interesting. It seems, or at least I get the impression you have a pretty distinct voice. So I don't know. It might not be as easy for someone to call in to mimic you, but I'll have to ponder on that, see if I even recall someone calling in to say that. That's kind of a peculiar one. Twins. Like, I don't even remember offhand someone calling in to say that they had twins per se. But,
Yeah.
How interesting.
Somebody wrote about, you know, my past contributions to the program, and they were mentioning that I was very helpful, but they said that I was married and have twins. So that was very odd to me. Very odd to me. I do not have twins, and I'm not married. So I'll go ahead and mute my line.
No,
can I be heard?
No twins, not married. Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
I think it just could have been like an error. I remember there was a caller who did announce. I think it might have been someone from Missouri or Kansas or something like that. Maybe like an engineer or in construction, or like one of them had like a wife who was a yoga instructor. It was one of them who said that they had twins. So it was just likely a mix up. I'll mute my line.
Good memory, Red in Nevada. Do you remember if that person sounded like Mr. Steele, or is that too much detail?
No, I didn't. I don't think anyone sounds like Mr. Steele. But thank you.
That's what I thought. He has pretty distinct timbre to his voice. Anywho, other folks dialed in. We have less than 10 minutes. Any other folks have final questions, comments that they wanted to share?
Hello, may I be heard?
Greetings, Irie.
Thanks, Thomas, in New York, for that tech update. It reminds me, I was talking to a white male. Well, he was talking to me. He was very happy to announce that Elon Musk has a program, Neuralink or something, that is planning to interface the human brain and synapses of the brain with computer capabilities within the next, I believe, decade or so. And looking, doing the quick overview of it, they say it's for the treatment of diseases, but I don't think so. And I find that to be interesting. You know, this development in lieu with that facial recognition technology that they're very, very adamant about developing, and now hearing that they can just take an image of a person's face and then create motion picture from it. Highly disturbing for me. It reminds me of, it's not exactly like the story, but it does remind me of Minority Report. And then also about the killings in Louisiana. In I believe it was Cleveland. There was not that much news about it,
down here. I do recall hearing a story on Democracy Now! About the gentleman, but not in like the local news or anything. And then the killings in Cleveland, it was reminiscent of the New York Police Department having willful and wanton negligence, in my opinion, with the missing of a college student, Ramona Moore. Her family, her mother, went to them and told them, my daughter is, you know, just a student. She doesn't go out. She only goes to school and she goes to work, and she is dependable to be home by this time every day that she leaves. And they said, oh, well, she's 18 now. She's probably out getting high, or she's probably, you know, having fun somewhere. And before too long, within the month or so of her going missing, they did find Ramona choked, I believe, and raped and dead in a basement in the Bronx, while simultaneously there was a young white woman that went missing at the same time. And they did like all points bulletin for her and had a van going around with a picture saying, have you seen this lady? So yes, very sad. I'm sad to hear that those women, or remember that those women, were on drugs. But, you know, like someone said a while back, they were responding to the system as best as they could. But yeah, and which is another thing, it just makes me think of the Malia Davis situation and how they are giving so much attention to the incorrectness of the mother and the so-called boyfriend or ex-fiance or whatever it is, and not focusing on finding the young woman as much as they are the, I suppose it's a metaphor, but the drama that is surrounding the disappearance. Wow. I'll mute my line. Thank you, everyone. Have a good night.
Thank you for sharing anything to associate black people with drugs. Like, oh yeah, that's what they do. Of course we shouldn't feel sorry for them or feel bad for them. If anything, you know, they should be admonished. Maybe we should arrest a parent or relative for this criminal conduct. I guess last few minutes, quickly, the caller in Florida, if you're still with us, sir, if someone were to say, you know, wait a second, sir, that was not white people who saw some importance to the albino panda. Those were non-white people in China who put up these cameras and say they were going to put up even more cameras just because they thought this is an interesting scientific study. You don't see an all-white panda every day, and these are not white people who are putting a value on this albino creature's life. What would your response to that be?
I would just ask, can you show me any evidence of any other animal or creature getting this much surveillance and cameras and technology focused on it too? Something, that's the first thing that came to my mind. Can they show me that? And then the reports to coincide with it.
Let's see. They have zoos, you know. They have lots of animals in zoos and shelters and wildlife preserves for animals that are not albinos.
And also, can I be heard? At these zoos, they oftentimes have 24-hour cameras set up, especially when they're giving birth. I can recall several times that I've scrolled through my Facebook news feed, and I've seen various animals sitting in some sort of pen, and the webcam is just streaming, waiting for them to begin the birthing process. So there are other examples. I think a better question would be in order.
And then especially when they get to mentioning the color of an animal. Because, like, they mentioned the birth of a giraffe a few months ago, I believe, but they didn't mention the color of the eye or anything or any form of pigment on the animal's body.
Oh, so you've seen the giraffe one. I've seen the giraffe. I've seen baby rhinos. And I think I've seen gorillas as well being focused on. with that surveillance. But when it comes to color, they do point out abnormal colors in crustaceans. I do remember seeing a 10-minute report on a crab that was actually blue, and a lobster that was actually blue. And I think that blue lobster actually is an albino lobster that just appears to be blue because of the biology of lobsters. So I don't know.
Yeah, because they seem to definitely put an emphasis on color, just like that's also a good point about the black rhino, white rhino, and they mentioned the decrease in the population because of poachers, but they don't really go on to say white people. They use general terms as to why the creature is decreasing in population amount.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now that's an area that I have looked into a little bit. Actually, most of the people that they're calling poachers are black. However, the customers for what they are poaching are primarily white and Asian. When it comes to some of these rare animals or some of these rare minerals that come from animals, including mostly focusing on ivory, tusks, and then keratin rhinoceros horns. Those are oftentimes purchased by customers from Asia. And the poachers that you see in the United States that are advertised on our airwaves, they're oftentimes the case they're financing some sort of conservation efforts. Now, I know that this is a talking point that they do put out there, but if you look at those nature preserves in these countries, oftentimes it will be a troop of black field workers, and the person that's in charge is some white person. So, you know, you're looking in the middle of Kenya and you see, you know, an army or a troop of field guys that look local. And then you see Chad, who's out front, who's ready to tell you all the facts about how many rare animals are left. And you can, you know, contribute your $25,000 to go ahead and kill one. So, yeah, but the overwhelming majority of poaching is done by people who would be classified as black.
We will leave it there. I think that point gets amplified frequently. That's another way that they will shift the blame away from individuals classified as white. They'll make sure, oh, yeah, the Negros, they're out poaching. I think when they had the report, we had the one about the white rhino a few weeks back that was on the continent as well, that it's, oh, yeah, the black people, that's what they do. They go out, kill. That's why we have to protect poor, helpless white pandas and giraffes and Snowflake. Remember that? They made that movie. I think it came out last year about the albino gorilla. I forgot what it's called, but that was based on Snowflake, I believe, real life albino gorilla that they pampered. I think they even killed all of her black relatives to get the Snowflake, the albino mutant gorilla. Anywho, we will be back. Workplace Racism, Sundown Towns. You can just check the front page for other broadcasts up and coming in the month of June. Again, next a week from tomorrow, if you are interested in the COW's 10-year anniversary counter-racist yoga retreat, California version, Labor Day weekend, August 29 through September 1, drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. Much obliged. Did we miss anybody? Anybody have a hand up that we missed totally? Okay, I was hoping didn't have any folks that I completely forgot about. You had a hand up. Again, thanks everyone for participating. I hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Drop an email if you have suggestions, gripes, can't find something in the archives, or other suggestions to offer untiljustice@gmail.com. Share the broadcast if you think it is constructive, would benefit other victims of racism, non-white people. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I think we heard that a few times this evening. Definitely apply that. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, driver, or passenger. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. Staying off the cell phone would be a great addition to that counter-racist plan. Anything that we can do to minimize problems, contact with racists. That being said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.